space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I make music with my friends.
He's got a laptop. He's got a laptop.
I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends.
He's got a laptop.
There it is.
He's got a laptop.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
You're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html where you can have access to not one but four separate chat rooms. As well as if you scroll down on the superchat.html, you can find a link to People for People Radio Network where you can go over there and join in and say hi to those nice folks as well. So it seems like we're living in upside down world or inside out world, because truth is the lie now. Question mark, question mark. Yeah, truth is the new lie. And so, you know, what we've been hollering about here on Mad Science for quite some time is about the way that the mainstream portrays, like, we're always in danger of, you know, things like climate change and droughts and floods and all this kind of stuff because of man-made, you know, events or whatever. And so, you know, whereas, you know, there are people out there who do tamper with the environment, there are people out there tampering with the weather. You know, there's actually a paper out there that was listed, Owning the Weather by 2025, basically weaponizing the weather kind of jazz. But either way, getting down to the brass tacks of all this kind of monkey business going on, is that, you know, they always try to say the debate is over. Yeah, it's been resolved. Most of the scientists say, well, I don't want to hear from most of the scientists because I know they all sellouts. But what I do want to hear from is all of the scientists, including the sellouts, because I want to get all sides of the story in order to be able to figure out which is the truth. But if you go all the way back to a video, which I might play portions of, Galen Windsor's nuclear scare scam, talk about how we could have had free energy a long time ago if this man was telling the truth about what he was saying. And of course, I believe what he said. But nonetheless, let's find out the truth on the deal. And when it comes down to climate science, who's telling the truth on climate science? And why would they not want to tell the truth? I mean, if you're a reputable scientist and you're going to go out there and tell people or publish papers saying this is this and that's that, well, I would think your reputation would probably be more important than whatever agenda you had going, because eventually time will tell the truth. It's going to come out regardless of whether or not you wrote the paper. And, you know, as many people want to try to holler when it's cold, it's climate change. When it's hot, it's global warming kind of jazz. Well, if you just paid attention in science class and learned about evaporation and condensation and all these different types of terminology, some related to a study called hydrology, which is studying, how water goes and how it works or whatever. But nonetheless, if you studied that and you studied all the basic science and physics and things that, you learn about supposedly in school, then things just don't seem to add up like they should if you're listening to one side of the story only. And so with that said, there's a whole lot more than meets the eye when it comes to all these different things. They're pretty much all intertwined. You know, how could nuclear industry be related to climate change or global warming or climate disruption or whatever's going to be next week when the math don't add up? Some people don't like it when I say that, but it's the truth, you know, because you can use these mathematical models to try to say just about anything. When you're shoveling 20 inches of snow off of your driveway during the winter time and they're trying to tell you how the planet's heating up, you're just wondering, what side of it we're at, because it ain't here, that's for sure. But that's global warming for you, right? And they talk about the different things about carbon emissions and how it's supposed to be a bad thing, or even methane or any other gases like that, you know, to try to say that these is what's causing the planet to heat up. You know, cow farting is actually going to cause it to get hot out, and we're going to have droughts and terrible weather and all this craziness. But I'm thinking way back before climate science and all that kind of stuff, there were lots of cattle, lots of herds of buffalo, and, you know, who knows, if you get to go back all the way to the dinosaurs must have been huge, you know, and imagine how much methane would come up out of that. But nonetheless, giving the devil his due, you know, you got all these people that say that there's an issue, And so when you come to the table to try to resolve that issue and you look really deep into the rabbit hole of science, so to speak, well, then you got to figure something out. Something ain't jiving here. All right, we got all this technology that could actually uplift humanity and end things like starvation and sickness and homelessness and so much more, and yet we're not using any of it, you know. And why would you not want to use something that was going to be beneficial to all of mankind? I mean, if you think about the wars and all that stuff going on around the world and how much damage and how much crud, just think about the carbon footprint of just a little war somewhere, you know. Some of them don't like to call them wars. Some of them like to call them like police actions. Really? Why are we the cops over there? We got crooked enough cops here, so why would we want to do that? Anyway, that's another story for another day. It don't matter. I got a couple podcasts that I picked out here that's got some pertinent information into to the point I'm trying to make here, and so let's see if we can get this on the road here. Let's see which one I want to go with first. There's so much. I'm gonna start with this one right here first.
I'll say it again. You know, there's one really obvious sign that global warming isn't now a science at all. It's a religion. And the sign is this. Anyone can now say any nonsense, any obvious untruth about global warming being a menace, the worst thing ever, run for the hills. And guess what? It doesn't matter. The facts don't matter. Say whatever you like. In fact, almost no journalist even thinks of correcting untruths. In fact, it's the opposite. They'd rather persecute the very few who dare. And I want to give you two fresh examples. One very important involving a doctors' union, the AMA, who you'd think would be above this kind of stuff, but I'm afraid it's been hijacked, it seems, by the left. But let me start with the other one first. One of the biggest global warming stories of the year, a scare story that went around the world, that a crew working with famous naturalist Sir David Attenborough had filmed walruses falling off a cliff, which they blamed, of course, on global warming. Now, if you're squeamish, look away.
There's probably 200 or 300 dead walrus on, like, a half-mile stretch of beach here. They're exhausted because they're having to swim 100 miles now to get to food and then coming back here because it's the only place to sleep. They used to sleep on the ice, dive down, eat food, sleep on the ice, easy. And now they're swimming 100 miles, coming to this place, climbing cliffs, and they're just exhausted and falling down and either being killed falling or just crushing each other because there's several thousand crammed onto little tiny bits of beaches.
This is the sad reality of climate change.
Gosh, global warming did that? Well, there are already a few problems with this story, not least the fact that, as with polar bears, walrus numbers have actually increased a lot over the past 40 years. If anything, global warming seems to have helped them. But there's now another reason to doubt this claim in Attenborough's film. It turns out that walruses have been falling off cliffs for years whenever population numbers soar and beaches get too crowded. And we know that because a documentary has turned up from 25 years ago, before the global warming religion took off, describing the very same phenomenon in Alaska, where there was no shortage of ice at all. Now, apologies for the poor quality of the video.
Massive walruses plummeting to their deaths along the Alaska coast. The walruses have displayed this bizarre and deadly behavior 3 times now over the last 3 years. He feels there's probably a real simple reason walruses are climbing the bluff. It's too crowded below.
So, is David Attenborough and his crew going to admit, oh, well, gee, maybe we dropped, you know, sort of jumped the gun. Maybe we got a bit ahead of ourselves blaming global warming for something that's, well, let's face it, it's been already happening decades ago. Apologize, correct themselves, as if. Because as we now know, being a warmist means never having to say you're sorry. So, I suggest you expect no sorries either from the AMA, our doctors' union, which today declared a global warming health emergency. Here is its national president, Tony Bartone, on the ABC today, making one claim after another about the so-called evidence of this climate emergency.
Rising incidences of mortality from heat stress, the rising weather events, the food insecurity.
Hold on right there. That's three claims and three falsehoods or deeply misleading half-truths, or at best, at the very best, three highly, highly contestable claims. And the ABC did not challenge a single one of them. Let's take them. First, rising deaths from heat stress? In fact, and as any doctor really should know, a recent study by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine has confirmed cold weather kills 20 times as many people as hot weather. Cold is deadlier than heat. And that's why, of course, our death rates in winter are higher than in summer. And it's why a warming temperature could actually help us. In fact, you know what's really a health risk here? Scaremongers, like the AMA, who cheer on the kind of disastrous global warming policies that make electricity in this country so expensive that many pensioners cannot afford to heat their homes. That's a health danger. Now, the AMA's second claim, more terrible weather events. Again, come on. Professor Roger Pielke Jr., he is undoubtedly one of the world's top experts on the cost of weather events. And he points out that even the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change admits there's little proof that weather is getting worse, more severe. In fact, we're getting fewer hurricanes, fewer cyclones, fewer tornadoes even. And in his latest book, Pielke says disasters have become less deadly, over the past century. Another strikeout for the AMA. As for its third claim, the AMA's third claim, that global warming is causing food insecurity, can't get enough to eat. Well, that is the craziest one of all. The Food and Agricultural Organization says world grain crops, things like wheat, rice, corn, instead steadily got bigger, more food. And the same is true here in Australia, despite the occasional and normal drought, one we've been having recently. So again, maybe, just maybe, global warming is good for us. Now, I have to ask you, there's not much ambiguity about what I've just said. I have to ask you why the AMA, which is supposedly representing doctors so concerned about science, Western medicine, science, why is the AMA then saying so much that is actually scientifically untrue, or half-true at best? And by the way, why is the AMA actually getting involved in global warming? Did it consult its members before putting out this rubbish? So I will say it again. Global warming means never having to say you're sorry. The bigger the exaggeration, the purer your heart.
Yep, that's, I'm going to play another one. I'm trying to work out a little issue so I can get the stream over there at People for People Radio, but you hear so much from the other side of how terrible the world is, but yet you never hear them talking about how to actually fix it outside of basically taking away people's freedoms and charging taxes and such. Anyway, let's move on here.
They really try very hard. And then every time that you say, though, you want to, I want to ask a question. No question. You just believe us. Every time you say, can we have a little debate? I don't understand your facts. Can you explain to me? They just say, no. Al Gore says so. So we go to this next one. It's another one. One of the world experts is.
Let me ask you, what percentage of the atmosphere is CO2?
What percentage of the atmosphere is CO2? I don't have that calculation for you, sir.
Maybe you could tell us what your personal guess is on what percentage of the CO2.
I don't make those guesses, sir.
You're the head of the EPA. You don't know. You have all of these laws based on, oh, you're going to get your staffer to tell you now. But you're the head of the EPA, and you did not know what percentage, and now you are basing policies that impact dramatically on the American people, and you didn't even know what the content of CO2 in the atmosphere was, which is the justification for the very policies you're talking about.
If you're asking me how much CO2 is in the atmosphere, not a percentage, but how much, we have just reached levels of 400 parts per million.
I was very clear what I was asking, and I was very clear you didn't know.
Well, we have a problem in the West, right? It's been known that that's all this wide-ranging forest fire is damaging our homes and so on and so forth, right? Whatever the reason is, apparently the Professor Jim Hansen from NASA Goddard Institute for Space Study, by the way, you all know who he is, right? He's the father of global warming. He's the man who testified in the Senate in 1988, making a clear statement that he's 99% sure that he has already seen the global warming effect by the carbon dioxide. Okay? This is telling you the level of stuff he's doing. He's presenting this talk to show that the forest fire numbers burn in the areas has been increasing, okay? And he showed data from 1960 to about 2017 or so. And this is based on a talk with children, okay? Student at the symposium in Taiwan. And I have to say that, you know, that seems very convincing, isn't it? If you are a big authority coming from America, former, you know, NASA director. But I think the God is angry right here, right? You know, something is burning. But the problem is, he's pulling such a childish sort of thing. He put actually a link to the data set where he got it from. But he forgot that the whole data set is available from 1926 or so. Why would he do such a thing, you know? He basically, you all understand, right? He was showing you only that little part, but he forgot to show you from 1926 to 1960. Isn't that childish? Are we serious about science? And these are called scientists, right? And I'm not supposed to tell people about this? This is just a sneak preview on my own study with my friend from University of Mexico by the name of Victor Velasco. We've been looking into the forest fire statistics. This is simply just to show you that the wildfire statistics from about 1930s or so until now, and then we make a forward forecast. We analyze the data. It turns out that the data has very strong, what you call, every 10-year kind of cycle. It has also every 40 years kind of cycle. And then we train the computer using some of this algorithm called artificial intelligence to actually make some forward forecasts, just simply to show that you can do some of this exercise. And I don't mean that I already know everything, but this is just an example of what science is all about. And then we know that it's summer now, so I'm obligated to show this chart from Professor John Christie of University of Alabama, Huntsville. Is to show you all this record daily hottest temperature in United States. United States has a very good temperature record, so we can go back about from 1895 until now. You can see it's been changing up and down, but then what we have now is just what it is. That's all it is, right? It has nothing to do with this, because they tend to use that, oh, every time there's a heat wave, it has to be global warming, right? The next statistics I'm going to show you is about hurricane. TC is tropical cyclone. The activity is going from about 1970s to now. The reason why you start in 1970 here is because this is the satellite era where we have satellite to look at all the statistics, so it's rather more accurate. But the point is, where is the killer trend? You look at anything you want, right? Tropical cyclone or extreme hurricane, they're going up and down, up and down, up and down, right? Where is the carbon dioxide algo? And then if you look at the more relevant, the impact type, the tropical cyclone that actually land on the, you know, come to the land and sort of cause damages. Category 1, 2, 3, and 4, these are, 3 and 4 and 5 are of course bad because the wind speed is high, probably a lot more rain as well. It's pretty much up and down, really. So, one of the things that we want to learn is always like that. You really, every time you hear a word, no wonder they say, for example, some people worry, why am I showing so many charts? Because you know why? Words are very bad because they are able to deceive you. You have to learn them. Every time they say this and that, you ask them, where is the data? I want to see the data. my good friend from Ireland say, where's the data, right? Let's look at the data. The first data I want to look at is tornado, for example. This is among the three strongest. The one that is tornado that is up to 140 miles an hour kind of wind, up to 200 miles an hour kind of wind. F3 to F5. And showing you the statistics from 54 to now. I don't know. I mean, maybe they like to say global warming causing the trend to go down. Oh no, it's not possible. It's not possible. Slide that you should see, right? On your left is the one that last year, when you are very warm on the land, you got no tornado activity at all in the May. But this year, kind of very cold in the Midwest, you tend to have a lot more tornado formation. It's just the opposite of what they say, by the way. Right? This is the typical graph they show from about 1880 to now, let's say. Right? You measure that, oh, the globe is warming. If you show the relationship with carbon dioxide, oh my God! Did you see it? It's almost a perfect correlation. If you plot the carbon dioxide on the horizontal axis, the global temperature on this is perfect correlation. The first reminder I want to remind everybody is that it turns out that this climate is among the most misunderstood subject, because Al Gore, the average D student, thinks that he understands climate. My God, it's as sure as gravity. He always say that. You guys are just denier, right? But to understand climate, you need to study what? Astronomy, solar physics, geology, geochronology, geochemistry, sedimentology, tectonic, paleontology, paleoecology, glaciology, climatology, meteorology, oceanography, ecology, archaeology, history. And that's not even complete. And these guys say that if we just change the carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere, that we're going to control the whole system. It's a bit ridiculous, actually. Right? Be serious. Science is very serious. So greenhouse effect, well, I'm not going to explain it because my friend going to kick me because we studied this issue very carefully. But the idea is that you added more carbon dioxide molecules, it's interact with the energy flow in the climate system, and if you have more carbon dioxide, you will tend to warm the climate, okay? So let's study this carbon dioxide. Who thinks that the most important greenhouse gas in the climate is carbon dioxide? Oh, very smart audience. It's actually H2O, really. It's water vapor, right? In all forms.
Okay, I'm going to pause that for a second because I want to read out a deal here. 212 degrees Fahrenheit, why evaporation occurs. Heat energy is necessary for evaporation to occur. Energy is used to break the bonds that hold the water molecule together, which is why water easily evaporates at boiling point, 212 degrees Fahrenheit or 100 degrees Celsius, but it evaporates much more slowly at freezing point. So, that's just one little key of why this whole thing about, so-called global warming / climate change or whatever they want to call it is a big hockahooey, because what you just heard that man say there is water vapor is the best greenhouse gas. And so you could imagine if the planet's heating up and at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, which if it ever gets that hot, we're really in trouble. But nonetheless, there's certain surfaces when the sun beating down on it that won't have any problem reaching that temperature and start to evaporate and putting more water vapor into the atmosphere. So with that said, then if water be the best deal for global warming, then we obviously don't want a lot more water vapor up in there. But on the other hand, when you think about it, when that water vapor gets up there to about several thousand feet where the temperature is a lot cooler, then what's going to happen from that point is it's going to condense and it's going to rain. And so in reality, it would get colder no matter how they try to twist this science around. It would get cooler. So let's keep going here.
Paper, snow, and ice at liquid form, right? That's in fact half of the job. If we want to study climate change and all that, you really need to study hydrology. Okay? And just to give you an example, don't mind the complexity. All the arrows is meant to tell you that, please don't get confused, but then it's to try to show you the climate is really complex. Okay? And I'm going to show you, if I click all the individual component and compare the role of carbon dioxide and water vapor in the climate system, let's say who is in charge, right? So first thing we go is we keep clicking. All the blue one turns out to be controlled by water vapor. There's no area, ice area, surface vapor pressure, relative humidity, soil moisture, evaporation, everything is blue. And then they say that if you just change the carbon dioxide, that you're going to get that. You're going to control the climate system. That's basically what it is. And then when you come down to water vapor, they occasionally like to put a picture like this. The one from power plant, right? By the way, please understand, you cannot see CO2, okay? Some kids from Sweden, the lady named Greta Thunberg, say that she can see carbon dioxide, actually. This is how bad it is, right? Instead of going to school to learn that carbon dioxide is in infrared, you cannot see this thing, okay? And she said that she can see CO2. So, it's just a bit of a joke. I just wanted to point out that the role of CO2, water vapor, is very important in the climate system. So, I'm showing you two graphs, okay? Top and bottom. The top graph is actually temperature. The bottom is water vapor, okay? And I'm showing you the distribution from South Pole to the North Pole. And then in the vertical coordinates, it's actually going from 0 to about 20 kilometers, right? What I'm showing you is that temperature and water vapor at one instant of time. Okay? It shows you that as you have more water vapor, the area tends to be warmer. As you have less water vapor, it tends to be cooler. Okay? That shows you how close the relationship of temperature and water vapor is in the climate system. And then in terms of time, at least we have two satellite measurements. The blue curve is actually showing you the temperature measurement. And then the red curve is actually showing you the water vapor concentration in the atmosphere detected by the satellite radiometer. Okay? They're pretty close relationship. Then I'm going to show you this because the ultimate things about science is about tests, right? You have a hypothesis, carbon dioxide increase. What does it do? Increase the greenhouse effect, yes? So a paper that published 2 years or 3 years ago, indeed trying to quantify this issue. And they tend to find that the last few years, you tend to have this so-called flattening of the greenhouse effect, which I will show you by this graph. From 1980 to 1991 or so, there appears to be some kind of increase of the greenhouse effect. And then by the time you reach about 92, 93, if you keep plotting the greenhouse effect, it seems to be flat, going up and down. So what this is telling you is that if you study the energy flow in the climate system, that the last few decades, it's been flattening. It's just, even though the carbon dioxide is rising, it's true, that one is still true, by the way. But the greenhouse effect has been flat. So what does this tell you? It tells you that carbon dioxide is actually playing a minor role in the total greenhouse effect in the climate system, really. Because this effect of flattening is caused by two things. The cancellation between the water vapor and the cloud effects, okay? But not controlled by carbon dioxide at all. This is actual measurements. If you don't like this, look at the result from Antarctica and Arctic. They measure something called the outgoing long wave radiation. Satellite could do those things. It's showing you something like this. So I think in terms of testing the empirical effects of what carbon dioxide do to the system, it's fairly convincing that no such thing exists.
Okay, let me pause this. Why is all this so important, you know? Why the climate change thing? Why is it all so important when it comes to, truth and mad science and stuff? Well, you know, if you're going to put, some sort of claim out there that we're in danger, of destroying our environment and the planet, so to speak, and then completely and utterly ignore all the solutions available to, say, if you don't want to run a vehicle that uses carbon, has carbon emissions or whatever. Never mind the fact that if you perfectly engineer these machines, you can get a perfect burn without any carbon emissions whatsoever. If you're going to ignore all those solutions, then you're not doing anything but fear-mongering people, telling everyone that the world is doomed because of man-made, carbon, whatever. Basically, we're polluting our air, so we're causing this. But even at that, you go back, you look at the nuclear industry, and if you really understood the truth about the nuclear industry, you'd be understanding that we were actually lied to and scammed about that. There's a video out there called Galen Windsor's Nuclear Scare Scam, which I'm going to try to get into portions of that anyway, but this is why this is so important. Because if you want to talk about real science, and you want to talk about real truth, then we need to get down to the real science and the real truth of everything. And every time anybody has an opposing view to what the mainstream wants to use to further their agenda, well, then they're basically demonized, called heretics or, you know, deniers or whatever. But, you know, the fact is this. If we were in as much danger as what they would like to claim we would, then they would be taking every solution, every one that they could get, because obviously, for obvious reasons, we'd be facing extinction if the world was as bad as they say it is. But that's not the case. The fact that oil industries, they never want to, have somebody put a product on the market that would compete with their sales of oil. You know, you got all this oil, you want to sell it. You want to sell it for the best price. And so somebody comes out and tells you you can engineer an engine using all the known laws of physics that would run on pure distilled water. Well, you can't have that. You know, that's going to cut your profits down. And even to the extent of nuclear power, why it's told to be so incredibly dangerous. You know, we're all going to die from radiation sickness and all this kind of stuff. It's all a lie. Every last bit of it's a lie. I paid attention in science class, and I paid attention all these years. And so, you know, when somebody says that there's a danger, and I step forward and I point out, look, hey, if you don't want to use this over here, then why don't we do this over here? You know, if your internal combustion engine's only 20-30% efficient, then there's room for improvement. So we can incredibly improve the fuel mileage so you'll use less fuel, and we can incredibly improve the air quality of the exhaust system. We have that technology. We've had that technology for so long, it's ridiculous. And, you know, the whole fossil fuel thing, it was a lie to begin with. There is no such thing as fossil fuel. But, you know, how can you tell the world that? Because they've been indoctrinated and educated to believe that that's the truth. You know, that bunch of dinosaurs died and made oil, and since there were only so many dinosaurs, we're eventually going to run out of oil. Folks, you're never, ever, ever going to see a time when you run out of crude oil. Now, hopefully you'll see a time when they use techniques like plasma gasification in order to get the perfect burn and all that kind of stuff. But in the meantime, they want to sell as much fuel as they possibly can. You know, we are carbon-based. Plants are carbon-based. Everything out there biological is carbon-based. And so that means we are actually a pollutant. And, you know, if you understand the system of what the Earth has been doing for however long it's been around, then everything, the Earth is a self-contained biosphere of epic proportions. It recycles everything back into the mix. It's always churning and mixing. No matter what you do, when you burn down the forest, you think that forest is gone. Well, all you did was change the chemical and the structure of what that was. You changed the chemistry, you know, but those materials are still there. They're just in a different form. And so that different form, those other materials, they get mixed back into the system, which is all part of the soup, you know, so to speak. So, you know, when it comes down to we're going to run out of this or we're going to run out of that, until the Earth stops doing what it's going to, what it has been doing, then there's no physical way we're ever going to run out of anything. So anyway, let's keep on rolling over here.
And then when you come down to global warming, just remember too, every time they say that if I warm the, have more carbon dioxide, I'm going to warm the climate by a few degree, let's say. But the few degree in the context of a city like a Boston, I'm basically showing you the daily temperature in Boston from January to December. Okay? And then they say the global warming going to change by 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 degrees Fahrenheit, let's say, on this scale. We go from anything from 10 degrees Fahrenheit to 80 degrees Fahrenheit. And we're talking about this.
Okay, I got to pause that again. There's a comment in the Mad Science chat room from Justine said, read and weep, never expect any interest and or help from science community. They are too busy fighting each other. The article is from September of 1961, but it's timeless. Even submitting some inventions to any university for independent rigorous testing and verification is just exercise in futility. It should be crystal clear from that document. Let's see. Don't read it to get discouraged. Just become better informed. Justine also posted a link to a PDF for that right there. But that's the whole thing, you know. We have technologies that are available that, you know, have actually been shelved by companies and basically hidden from the public knowledge for obvious reasons. They want to make money, and they're always going to be able to make money and maintain power as long as they can keep the people duped into believing that we really need them. We don't need them. We don't need the system. We don't need the power grid for that matter. If we come together and we engineer these machines that I'm talking about, then we will have all the energy we need to run, all the appliances that we run right now on a regular basis. See, right now, you go flip the light switch off, and instantaneously, it's like we're in a cab, and the meter's ticking, and you're going to end up paying, you know, for whatever that you use. And so, with that said, if your bills are skyrocketing because of this scam that they call global warming, then, you know, that's, to me, stealing. It's flat out stealing. And this is why this is so important. This is why, you constantly hear me talking about this whole global warming / climate change or climate disruption or whatever it's going to be next week when the math don't add up. It's a flat out stealing from people using false science and in most cases just straight up fraud. And so got to point these things out. But by pointing these things out, people who are already basically in the church of Scientology, so to speak, or the church of global warming, they're not going to listen to you. They're going to fight you and call you every name in the book, even though you're sitting there pointing out the solution to the problem that they claim exists. And this is why mad science is so important, because if you say there's a problem, yet you ignore the solution to said problem, then what's going on? What gives here? You said that we're going to die within 12 years. You're telling all the children that we got to save the planet. Well, if this is the case, then why are you ignoring all these alternative energies? Why are you ignoring the people out there who's been trying to show you forever and a day a better fuel system or a way that you can use anything in this world could be used as fuel if you understand the physics of it? Anything. You can extract energy from anything on this world that we live in. It's all energy. And, you know, we pump radio waves after radio waves through the atmosphere. All of that's energy. The water vapor out there is energy. If you think about just the basic concept of how your microwave oven cooks your food, then a light bulb should come on in your head to say, look, if we can do this with that little box, What could we do with a larger system, such as maybe what Tesla was talking about back in the old days, sending wireless energy through the atmosphere? Because we're basically floating in a sea of water that has been vaporized in gases and things. So, you know, we're quite literally underwater right now. You know, it's just broken up. There's this pocket in here, and we can breathe the oxygen. You know, in liquid form, you obviously can't breathe it like you would unless you're a fish. So, if you paid attention in science class and you understand physics, then that's what's going on right here. if it wasn't for the evaporative portion of our environment, we wouldn't have no air to breathe. It would we'd be living in the water. We'd be like fish, have to have gills and stuff. But since we aren't, and since we understand that you could put a wave through the water in liquid form, you can also put a wave through the water in the air atmosphere as well. We know how to send radio signals back and forth. We know how to send ripples across the pond, so to speak. But, you know, this is why all this stuff is important. And this is why dissenting views are important. This is why I'm playing these podcasts, which let's go ahead and continue with this. It gets better.
Tiny thing that is very hard to detect, even if you allow their theoretical speculation to be true. So I want to show you this case that is very, very outrageous. What I'm plotting here is three curves. Two curves is basically the blue and the red curve. They are what you call the satellite temperature measurement of the global temperature. From about 1990-something to about, let's say, present time. It's going up and down, but it's flat, right? This is what the famous thing called the global warming hiatus. It's not warming up, while the carbon dioxide is still rising. And then another data set that shows is rising is produced by NASA Goddard Institute for Space Study. The two satellite data is measuring something from a layer about a few kilometers up from the atmosphere. What is measured by NASA GIST, Goddard Institute for Space Study, the green curve, is from the surface thermometer data. We don't believe that data is true, of course, by the way, so we're working on those class of problems. But here I want to refer to a case by the group called RSS. They are from Santa Rosa, somewhere here. They are actually showing that curve in 2016. And then I want to remind, because every time that in science, that if you can do as many independent measurements that you can, there it's becoming more interesting. I just want to remind you on the middle panel, the RSS and the University of Alabama Huntsville data agree with each other. There's a flat trend. But there's actually a third data set that is measured by another technique, okay, from a Taiwanese group. They're actually using some very special technique of looking through the atmosphere and do that sort of thing, radio occultation, for people who wants to know. It actually shows satellite flat trend, by the way. So what do we do? We have three data sets, four or five data sets. Three of them kind of show flat here, right? Because they're measuring the atmosphere. And this guy from the surface showing the warming. So is it really true that this hiatus, this so-called hiatus, you understand this, right? If the temperature is not always coming, is rising, they actually consider this a disaster for them. Instead of saying that, hey, maybe we are wrong, carbon dioxide is not important. No. This will shake all their foundation. They don't like it. Okay? So they started to say that these are fantasy created by people like myself. Okay? So they have BBC say, What happened? We need to study this. And then you even have, sorry for the quote, but anyway, there are folks in scientific community talking among themselves saying that we're in trouble now because we cannot explain why the temperature is not warming up. So it shows you that they are worried internally. And even worse, a very famous professor by the name of Professor Phil Jones from UK was actually writing to his colleague from the UK Meteorological Met Office because they were making forecasts. They even forecast that the temperature will keep flat for about 2020. Remember this, okay? I'll make the point later. Because even forecast is showing that it's going to show flat. Because, you know, they want to show that they can predict this. Oh, we understood this thing. But it will warm again. You just wait. It's going to warm again. And look what happened. 3 years later, RSS temperature now agree with the Goddard Institute for Space Study. So, if the data don't fit your theory, what do? You change the data, guys. Be smart. Why not? That's okay. So they were talking things like that. They're beginning to talk among themselves that maybe, you know, satellite data, by the way, is measuring something in the troposphere, like few kilometers up the air. It's actually a good measurement because they're measuring something from the vibration of this oxygen molecule that is very uniform, okay? Because it's very same amount of constant, 21% everywhere. Carbon dioxide, there will be a lot in this room, few thousand parts per million. Outside is 400, things like that. It's very good. And then now they say the surface thermometer data that has all kinds of problems is okay. So this is the summary. When the data don't fit, you just change the data. Okay? So then I'm going to get into another case that is very serious. This is very serious. The man on the right or left is Michael Mann, and then the other one is the famous Bill Nye, the science guy? Celebrity. But anyway, this is concerning a very serious problem. Michael Mann is well known and associated with a phenomenon called hockey stick temperature history. This is actually a paper that's been produced showing that the temperature could not change much from 1000 AD to 1900 AD, very flat, and then it warm up from 1900 to now, zoom it up. Never mind the hiatus, of course. And then, most people are studying this flat part. Okay, actually, I produced a paper myself. In fact, my paper was the first one ever produced in 2003. Now, I want to focus in on the blade problem, okay? Let me show you. I wrote a scientific paper just to make a point to say that we studied this issue carefully. And then I want to tell you that Michael Mann was very worried about this, so he put out in the blog saying that, oh, there's this so-called attack paper. In science, when somebody criticizes your work, you'll be very, very happy if you're an honest scientist. Because according to Michael Connolly, my good friend, saying that we learn more than, right? Instead of saying, oh, this guy is attacking me, he's from denial club, and so on and so forth. So he actually claimed, blamed that, you know, I was trying to attack IPCC. No, Michael Mann, I was attacking your work, not IPCC. Really, he was so proud. He was so proud that he tried to stop my paper from publishing. He was influencing this American Geophysical Union that published that journal, Geophysical Research Letter, where I printed in 2004, calling them that I have violated copyright in my paper. Therefore, the paper shall not be published. Let me show you the problem. You can look here. It's a bit hard for me. Okay, left. Okay, from left to right, you have three data sets. Michael Mann 2002, Michael Mann et al. 2003, and then Michael Mann and Jones 2003. And then the one to your right is my results. I try to emulate whether you can get this temperature change. This is actually the temperature change for the last 150 years or so, right? You notice that in less than one and a half years, 2002 to about 2003, you notice that the N curve, the red curve, is what I want you to focus on. It keeps changing, it keeps going higher. Do you understand what it means? It's impossible. Under any data, any condition, the data could not change by 1 year, especially this one is 4-year filter. You smooth it out so you don't want to study the year-to-year changes, so you study the long-term changes. Do you understand? This is the part where nobody discussed this. I actually have published a paper on this to point out that I consider this case is a scientific fraud, in my humble opinion. Okay? He came back and talked nonsense again. It's very sad. How many years already? 2004? Okay? You think about it. And he was very proud. There's actually a proof that he actually talked among himself that he was so proud, really soon going to have this paper coming out, but I was so powerful, I'm Michael Mann, I'm able to stop him. Okay? Because he was colluding with the American Geophysical Union, Geophysical Research Letter folks, about able to stop me from printing. Unfortunately, I was rather smart by that time. Actually, I've gotten all the permission to redraw the figures and to show it the way I show it. Okay? There's nothing wrong with actually taking a science. Oh, another very simple point about science. You all believe, right? If you have a data that makes something, and then you've already published your paper, do you think that we can should ask them to get the data so we can check the data? Do we agree? Raise your hand.
Yeah.
And do you know what is the typical answer, right? No, 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 the dog ate my homework. No, you cannot have it. If I give it to you, you just want to destroy my idea. That kind of work, okay? I'm not joking. This is how serious science is. And these are always their side that are doing that. If they ask ourselves, Michael Connolly and Ronan Connolly, that they want our data, please have the data. In fact, every time we publish, we make sure the data is already out there, right? You don't do things like that. And then he become actually delusional. He think that he's a Holocaust survivor. He claiming that we're doing things like this.
Let me ask our director for a second. If he can go on a wide shot, I don't know if he can get everybody on all at once. But I wonder, in the midst of your lecturing to your students, whether any of you, and I'm sorry, I don't want to get too touchy-feely here, but, I mean, this is what our subject is about tonight. Anybody started to cry? Or broken down? Or just had an emotional moment where you were overcome? Anybody?
Yep.
Michael, I see you nodding.
Yep.
What happened?
Yep.
What happened?
Yep. Sometimes I'll be talking about not just the science, but the denial, denial industry, and the things that fossil fuel interest did to lead us astray that are so like what the tobacco industry did decades ago to lead us astray on the health impacts of tobacco. And I'll tear up, especially when I'm talking to an audience of young people, because you know, what a terrible injustice we've done them, or we've allowed others to do them, by misleading them on what is arguably the greatest challenge we face as a civilization. Sometimes I tear up just describing that, talking about that.
Well, one of the IPCC is very fond of putting out this curve. They say that on your left, you have a lot of this orange line and the red curve, they are all model calculation. And then the black curve is actually observation. They can explain everything, okay? If they include the carbon dioxide. And then on the left, this blue one,
on the right.
Include only the, on the right, yes. That you include only the volcano and the solar, it won't do anything because it deviates. I have to tell you, if anybody have any understanding of statistics, this is actually an abuse of statistics. And also, statistics, I'm not interested. I'm interested in physics. You notice the unit that they plot. They always plot this thing called the temperature anomalies, which is a very strange word. It's actually a temperature deviation from some averages, okay? But if you plot in the actual temperature unit, temperature, the ice freezes at 0 degrees, isn't it? The ice gets boiling at 100 degrees. If you plot in absolute unit, look, the dotted line now is actually the observation, and then the data, the model calculation is all over the place. But when you do a temperature anomaly, you actually squeeze them together, you hide it so your data look very impressive. I think rule number one in science is that you don't oversell your results. So in fact, they should have showed this plot, but they never ever showed this plot. It took them a long time until 2012, the first plot like such kind appeared. It has to be done by amateur scientists, okay, to make those kind of plots. And of course myself, but I don't need to publish paper like that. So US Global Change Research, it's actually a well-known one because they are now making a fuss out of this report, right, being something important and it's against President Trump, so on and so forth. But among the stuff that they show is that they take all those results from IPCC and they show you that, look, instead of temperature anomaly, they can plot the temperature unit in absolute unit, Fahrenheit actually. Somebody that really crazy that they convert the unit of anomaly, a change, to actual unit. That's how bad it is. EPA is doing the same thing. That is wrong actually, by the way. So I asked the question, where's the peer review? If, by the way, this is a phenomenon that is very serious. It's going to kill science in my humble opinion. Because it's not about peer review anymore. It's all power review system. And it's very, very urgent and very, very dangerous. If you care about science, you really need to speak out. So, it's really true. It's from the, basically, anomalies. Instead of showing all those ranges, there's somebody foolish think that you can convert this into absolute unit. But these things are not representing that at all. Okay? I hope you understand that. And this is just another example to remind you. The model is all over the place. They have too much ice, too little ice, and all that kind of stuff. When they have too much ice, okay, I'm going to melt some of the water and throw it into the ocean. It's showing you that the climate modeling is in a very big trouble state. Then, that was long ago, maybe about 10 years ago, but now I want to show you even more recent example. This is a very prestigious lecture in JPL and Caltech. Von Karman, Theodore von Karman is a very good fruit dynamicist from Caltech. That this guy was giving a talk, and he was talking about carbon dioxide and temperature change for 800,000 years from Antarctica. But the problem is, the ice core data is showing you the temperature anomaly, the difference. Do you understand? It's showing you the difference between certain mean period. So it's the change of the temperature. But this scientist, so-called scientist, in 2017, was converting 0 to 32 degrees Fahrenheit. I hope you get it, please. It's just very simple kind of goofy. It's like, I don't want to laugh at him. But it tells you that this is how delusional the whole field is. This is supposed to be an expert talking to public audience. Because they want to make sure that you're more familiar, you can feel the temperature, right? You know this. But nonsense again. So this is the kind of important public policy question, right? If it's so important, why they keep pulling out all this stunt, graphical kind of stuff? Remember, I tell you, I don't believe in this persuasion business, you know? Science is all about evidence, and data. So the question is, can the climate model simulate? If you think climate model is important, because that's what they use for policy, right? For the next 100 years. They say, now it doesn't matter. You don't even need to validate the model, actually, they say. All I care is that if I increase carbon dioxide, it's going to warm for the next 100 years. Okay? But let me do another test. Can we simulate something simple called the seasonal cycle in the climate temperature data. So I'll show you that if you plot the information of the seasonal cycle of the temperature, northern hemisphere temperature, from about 50 years, you plot something on the vertical axis called the amplitude, you know how large the season number is, and then the phase, the timing of the peak, whether the summer warming and winter cooling sort of thing, when it comes. You'll see that the data, the climate model data is all over the place. So let's see if they can hit the jackpot. Where is the observation, right? So the observation is right here. Oh, they miss it by a lot. It's bullseye, man. I'm going to throw my dart. It's going to hit somebody, right? So season is very serious. Come on. Listen what I just told you. Yeah. The climate model cannot produce a seasonal cycle. And they tell you they know something about the climate system, isn't it? Okay? Then another serious scare that they always do is that they say, oh, the last 150,000 years ago, there's a period called the Eemian warm period. Because remember, now we're living in a period called interglacial, called the Holocene. And then 20,000 years ago, we live in an ice age, right? When the ice is about 2 miles thick in Boston and New York and reach as far south as Delaware, there's a lot of ice. So the big swing, the climate system going up and down. But every time they talk about season, every time they talk about other warm period, they use the Eemian, the 150,000 years ago, 115,000 years ago. But I want to remind you that it's completely different Eemian from now. Because now you have this solid curve. Our seasonal amplitude changed by only 90 watt per meter square. But Eemian, the orbit was less circular, so it's more eccentric. So therefore, the seasonal cycle is changed by 230 watts. So every time they talk about even Eemian being equivalent, like because they say Eemian, all the Greenland ice sheets melt. But that's a very different condition from now. It doesn't mean that the Greenland ice sheet would melt again, of course. And then I want to do another test about climate model. Because according to them, that if one model is wrong, that's okay. You know why? Because we're taking a lot of averages, right? This is actually a quote that is slightly embarrassing. I don't wish to embarrass him, but he actually said it. It's by a professor of chemistry from Rice University, of course a Nobel Prize, that he said, the sobering conclusion about future warming using climate model are based on these elaborate models, right? It's usually wise to be suspicious of a computer model of complex situation, but we're not talking about one scientist model. It's a number of programs give similar results. With that, let me challenge Professor Koh. But I ask you to look. If I have all this bunch of passenger jets, do you want to know what the average passenger jet is? And if I show you, would you go on it? Right? So, it's mean that if you average all the result that is wrong, it doesn't mean that you're going to get it right, right? You're going to get it more wronger. I don't know what it is. Here's what the average passenger jet look like, right? So I don't think we want to take that jet, right? I hope we can send our go on that one. So, it's a very simple proposition. If you really think that you can solve the problem like that, you give me a faster computer, right? But I want to point out that there are many follies. Just two examples to show you the problem of current day, today, 2019. What kind of problem we have in climate model? Here is one example. The first example is to ask the question, how well can the GCM, which is the Global Circulation Model, which is the global climate model, right? How well can it simulate cloud structure? On your right is observation. On your left is the GCM, right? The computer model. It really don't agree too well, isn't it? Mm. Right? You cannot simulate the cloud. You're going from 90 south pole to north pole. You go vertical high, right? From surface to basically high up in stratosphere or troposphere, right? It's very bad. And then you ask a simple thing. How about sea surface temperature? More or less similar. If you compare, this is actually a calculation, and then you compare with the difference with the observation, you can see that large part of the Pacific Ocean and Atlantic Ocean are cool by relative to actual observation for 5 degrees Celsius. That's quite large, by the way. So for climate model, I have very simple proposition. That most of the time, they got the right result for the wrong reason. And then people like to say GIGO effect. The well-known GIGO effect is garbage in, garbage out. For me, that's not a problem. If it's garbage in, garbage out, I just ignore it, right? It's garbage in, gospel out is the problem. I'm very far near the end now, so please be patient. The thing I want to show now is basically about sun-climate connection, which is my area of study. The picture is just to give you the essence that the sun is powering all the energetic in the system. The typical story how IPCC would say sun is not important is to show you a graph like this. They use a concept called radiative forcing. According to them, carbon dioxide gives you 1.82 watt per meter square over the last 260 years. And then the sun gives you only 0.04 watt per meter square. Game's over, right? Really, they win. I clap hand because if this is true, if this is how the climate functions, is to look at the change in the system all the time and not even think about season, this is why they avoid season, okay? And that's the reason. The same information, you can plot it like this. Because the sun is indeed the big giant gorilla in the climate system. This is actually a very nice picture of the sun in X-ray, taken by some colleagues from my workplace in X-ray. So, to finish off, I want to show you another way. Those that came and saw me last night at the library in a church in Woodside, California, that I show a way to study sun-climate connection, which is to say that because the thermometer data is very confused, if you take the urban data, you don't know what it means, so you take some rural station, so you study that to see whether there's any implication of the sun effect there. I think I show that there is some effect, and we have published paper on that. This is another way to look at it. So my proposal for tonight is to say that if you want to study the sun effects on this climate system, you better don't go and study the temperature during the night, isn't it? Am I right? So you study during the daytime maximum. That's basically the question. I think I should skip a lot of this slide, but I want to show you a bottom line. It's not a good idea at all to study the temperature during the night for the sun effect. Because at the night, you tend to form this thing that there's a cold stuff near the surface and the warm stuff. So you have what you call a boundary layer. So the atmosphere and the surface are not so connected because the thermometer is sitting on the surface. During daytime, it's a lot more easier to study this, right? Because it's more connected to the surface. Okay? So it's really an amazing simplicity. It's just something in the hunch that I say. You study the sun effect during daytime maximum daily temperature. If actually not so cloudy, guess what happened? You might be able to see something like this. The blue curve is the temperature maximum, the late daily temperature maximum from the United States versus the solar irradiance, the red curve. If you don't believe that, you also can see that in Canada. If you don't believe that, you can see roughly of that picture in Mexico. Okay? And then finally, because the metric that I measure is called the solar irradiance, it's actually giving you information about the sun's incoming radiation more or less near the surface, more or less near the atmosphere at the top. There's a basic problem that we have a problem because this is the hardest science problem for climatology, which is to understand cloud. What does it do? What does it change more? Because in cloud, there's so many types, you know, that sort of thing. So, do we have evidence to see that the effect of the sun at this upper atmosphere reach all the way to the surface? That is extremely hard to find the data. It turns out that I was able to find one set of data, okay, that shows that the radiation does reach the surface. If I plot some of the temperature data with the ground solar radiation, it shows some kind of correlation, similar picture, that you cool from this period, you warm 1930s, 40s, you cool in the 70s, you warm up again, okay? So my takeaway message tonight is this. There are simply no experimental data to support the view that the Earth is changing in a very strange way or dangerous way. By carbon dioxide, by the sun, by whoever, you know. And then one thing that we are sure, carbon dioxide is just a big player in the climate system. So the idea that you can have this carbon dioxide knob, that turning up and down is just an illusion, right? Because they imagine that this is a climate knob, that you just adjust the thermometer up and down. I would say X, right? Basically not true. And then my third point is that the sun is, in my humble opinion, is primary driver of climate change and one should study as much as possible. Again, I do not make the claim that we have found the evidence. I'm merely showing you that there's a lot of interesting hint that one should study and understand the exact way in which to have the sun affect the Earth system, including sea level change, all this other stuff. And then you have to remember climate model, that famous thing, the tools. They actually come at tools. I say it's so misleading. It's really not like knife at all, where you can use to chop, you can do so many things, including killing people. You can do so many things. This climate model is almost useless, in my humble opinion. It's supposed to be some kind of a pedagogical tool, some tool to learn, you know? But it's not for forecasting at all. It's simply not ready. Right? Because they cannot represent a lot of this physics and chemistry and all this problem. That's what the problem with climate model. It can never be used for public policy, no matter how many people say about, no matter what the Supreme Court is saying. This is my last slide. My last slide is to quote a good friend of mine by the name of Professor Richard Lindzen, retired already from MIT, because he's a bit fed up. He needs a rest. He really said that this problem is rather serious, really. He said when the historian, what historian would definitely wonder about in the future century, is how deeply flawed logic, obscured by shrewd and unrelenting propaganda, actually enable a coalition of powerful special interests to convince nearly everyone, except lucky few like us, right, in the world that carbon dioxide from human industry was a dangerous, planet-destroying toxin. It will be remembered as the greatest mass delusion in the history of the world, that carbon dioxide, CO2, the life of plants, was considered a time to be a deadly poison. Okay, I finish. Thank you.
See, that's why I want to share that with you, because that's probably the one of the best ones I've heard yet. I'm going to also play another one, then I'm going to go back towards the one that I was talking about, the scare scam, because the deal is, if they claim that there's a problem, and they still aren't willing to look at the solution, then I would say we have a serious issue. It doesn't have anything to do with truth. It has to do only with power. That's it, plain and simple. So I hope I clicked the right one here. Let me see if this is it.
Welcome to Conversations That Matter. Joining me now is Mike Minear to talk about our guest today, who is going to be a little bit of a controversial figure. Mike, who are we having a conversation with today?
Well, we're talking to William Happer from Princeton. You had to go a good distance to...
Clear across the country, yeah.
That's right, but well worth the interview. William Happer is one of the leading scientists in the United States. He's a physicist located at Princeton University in Pennsylvania. He is a well-decorated scientist. The National Academy of Science is a fellow with the American Physical Society, and the list goes on and on and on. He's probably best known here in recent years, though, because he is a scientist who says the consensus is wrong on climate change. He just thinks it's not really that big of an issue. And not only does he think it's not so bad of an issue, he thinks there may actually be some upside to it for the globe.
Well, where he thinks that upside exists is in CO2 levels. He actually says that we're in a CO2 drought. Not that we have too much, but that we don't have enough.
And yeah, that's exactly right. And that rather than it being the death knell for civilization, that actually it's good for plants and vegetables, and we should actually be benefiting from increased levels of carbon dioxide.
My conversation with him shook me quite a bit, because I wasn't expecting to hear somebody, especially in the world in which we're living right now, come out and be so bold as to say, no, this is a good thing.
That's absolutely right, and you know, it takes a scientist like him, who's so renowned and respected, probably a lot of courage, quite frankly, to come out and make this type of a statement. So a very interesting conversation for sure.
It definitely was, one that I'm sure will bring an awful lot of comment. In telling people about it, I've had some pretty strong reaction already, so...
Well, that's why we call it Conversations That Matter.
It's true, and it's a conversation worth having. Let's go to that conversation now.
Welcome to the second of our conversations from Princeton University. Joining me today is Mr. William Happer. Mr. Happer, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. it's not very often that we get to talk to somebody who, with your level of scientific background, about climate, because when it comes to discussing climate, you actually have a sense of what's going on. And I frame that by saying sense, because I think that the topic of the science of climate is very complex. Am I right about that?
Oh, yes, it's a very complicated system.
Do you understand where we're at as far as climate is concerned? Are we changing as a result of human activity? Is human activity contributing? And if so, then to what extent?
Well, of course, the climate changes all the time. It always has. And it's warmed a little bit in the last 100 years, apparently.
About 0.8 degrees Celsius?
Maybe, yeah. Nobody knows whether that's got a human component or not. I mean, most of the warming, for example, was over by 1940, you know, long before there was much additional CO2 in the air.
But there was a period in the late 1980s where the temperature did spike.
Indeed, there was warming of 3 or 4 tenths of a degree from 1980 to year 2000.
But there were a couple of years in there where we had an El Nino and an El Niña effect.
Right.
Did that play a role? Do we know that for certain?
Well, you see El Nino is very clearly on the temperature record. Whenever there's El Nino, the whole Earth looks a little bit warmer. That's because the Pacific gets covered with warm water that used to be all pushed together against Australia and Indonesia, but during El Nino, it spreads back all the way to South America.
Right, so it reverses its flow across
that's
the Pacific.
Yeah.
And then radiates up and down the coastline of North America.
There was a monster El Nino in 1998, which sort of was the peak of the warming. So that was a bit artificial.
Mm-hmm.
But there are El Ninos every 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. You do work with the U.S. government in helping people to understand climate. When you talk to them about the way that climate is presented, uh-huh, what are you telling them these days?
The government doesn't normally ask me these days, but I do tell them that, you know, climate obviously is important. It does change. There's very little evidence that humans are making much impact. And as far as CO2 is concerned, which is the major focus, that's probably more good than bad.
Now, I can hear people yelling at the screen right now saying, what do you mean CO2 doesn't make much difference?
Well, you know, I know a lot about CO2 compared to most climate scientists because we make CO2 lasers, you know, and CO2 is a very interesting molecule. And the particular mode of CO2 that contributes to global warming is CO2 is a rod, and it bends like this, up and down, up and down. And it's that bending motion that causes the global warming. But that is such a strong absorption that it's saturated now. So as you add more CO2, most of what you can do has already been done. There's still a little addition, but not very much.
Can you explain that to me in a little greater depth? What do you mean it's already been done?
Well, if you have a barn, you know, and you want to paint it red, you know, if you put a thin paint of red paint, it may not be quite red enough. If you put two or three, then it really looks red. After that, if you add more red, it doesn't make much difference. And so that's sort of what CO2 is doing now, that most of the easy absorption has been done. And so as you add more CO2, you get a little broadening. I don't want to get too technical.
Well, no, I find this fascinating because, and the reason that I find it fascinating is that I hear that, okay, we've gone from about 320, 330 parts per million going back. Mm-hmm. In the last 100 years now to just shy of 400 parts per million if we measure it in Hawaii.
And
along the way we've heard predictions of different catastrophic outcomes as we push our way through different maximums. I haven't seen them happening, even though people will attribute some weather change to that.
Yeah.
You're saying that if we push through 400 and get to 500, the difference between 350 and 400 is greater than that between 400 and 500. Is that the... Am I right?
There's an interesting thing about CO2, which is unique to CO2. It's not true, for example, of water vapor or methane, and that is that if you get 1 degree of warming from doubling CO2, so going from, say, 400 parts per million for simplicity to 800, that doubles it.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose that causes 1 degree of warming. Then to get another degree of warming, you have to double 800, so you have to go to 1600. So you have to double it again. So it gets harder and harder to warm. Technically, they call that the logarithmic dependence of temperature rise on CO2 concentration. It was first guessed at, really, by Svante Arrhenius, you know, who did some of the earliest work on global warming. He thought it was good, you know, he was all for global warming. But he was the first one to point out this doubling property of CO2. Nobody quite knows how he guessed it. It's correct.
Because he wasn't using computer models.
Well, I mean, it was before quantum mechanics, you know. He didn't even know about spontaneous emission. It was before Planck. But nevertheless, he guessed it correctly.
It's quite remarkable,
guy.
Isn't it?
Quite a guy, yeah.
So, CO2, you know quite a bit about it.
Yeah.
Is it all negative? And if not, then what are the benefits?
Well, I think the main benefit of CO2 is it's... the food for plants. Plants really need three things. They need light for photosynthesis, they need water, and they need CO2. Plants are made of carbon. You know, when I hear about carbon pollution, you know, we're all made of carbon. Plants are made of carbon. People made of carbon. You know, your hamburger's made of carbon. But CO2 is used by plants. If you go to a cornfield, for example, in midsummer, and you measure CO2, it's about half what it would be at night, because the corn plant has sucked so much CO2 out of the air that it's now limited on how fast it can make new sugar and grow by the amount of CO2. So if you double the CO2, the corn can grow better. There's more of it there. It doesn't suck it down so quickly. So that's number one, is it's an essential plant food. And the other thing is it gives drought resistance to plants, because a plant has this problem that when it gets CO2, it doesn't suck it up from the roots. It has to open up little holes in its leaf, and so CO2 molecule bounces around and other air molecules gets into the hole. For every CO2 that goes into this hole, 100 water molecules may fuse out from the interior of the plant. So the plant is squandering water as it's trying to, you know, make food, you know, from photosynthesis. So if you look at, say, a gram of sugar, to make a gram of sugar takes 100 grams of water, you know, so there's huge amounts of water used in photosynthesis now, more than should be, because we're essentially in a CO2 famine. If you look at
the... We're in a CO2 famine.
Famine, we have too little CO2.
So it had 400 parts per million.
400 is still too small, yeah. If you look at the geological history of the world, you know, we started getting good fossils about 550 million years ago,
mm-hmm.
the Cambrian.
Yeah.
Since that time, CO2 levels have averaged thousands of parts per million, not a few hundred parts per million, you know, much, much higher, factors of 4, 5, 10 even. And so plants really evolved when there was a lot more CO2 to eat. You know, now they don't have enough. And you can see lots of evidence for that. There's certain plants, for example, that they're called C4 plants that are adapted to the low CO2 levels we have now. They typically are in hot regions of the earth. Sugarcane is an example. Corn, American corn, maize is another example. But most of our agriculture plants use the old-fashioned photosynthesis, which is called C3. And that's a more efficient way to operate if you have plenty of CO2, but there isn't plenty of CO2 anymore. There's not enough. So as CO2 levels have been going up, the old-fashioned C3 plants, and that includes soybeans and wheat and cotton, actually most plants are C3.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing very, very well. I mean,
with an increase in CO2.
With an increase in CO2. Very, very noticeable. It's a huge effect. You know, it's worth hundreds of billions of dollars every year in agricultural productivity. It's so when people talk about the social cost of carbon, it's absurd. You know, the social cost is negative of CO2.
Now, yeah, because it's a net contributor.
It's a net contributor to agricultural productivity. that's not, you shouldn't confuse that with real pollution from a coal plant. You know, a coal plant, if you don't build it right, it scatters fly ash all over everybody. It may have sulfur, and you know, all sorts of horrible things can come out. But the CO2 is actually good.
But we're not paying attention these days to that coal plant so much.
Yeah.
So much of our focus seems to be on man-made global warming.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you think that we're missing our, the appropriate target right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's another one of these sort of mass hysterias that have gripped humanity since it began. You know, in our country, in America, we had a sort of similar case of mass hysteria with Prohibition. There were a few cautious people who said maybe, you know, Prohibition isn't a good idea, you know, might increase organized crime, for example. Yeah, everything they said was right, and yet, you know, when the amendment for Prohibition was put to the vote, every state except one, Rhode Island, voted for Prohibition, and not one of them intended to honor it, you know. It was just what everybody else did. You know, how could you be in favor of demon rum, you know, demon CO2? So these things happen, you know. More sinister are these movements in Europe, you know, the fascists, you know, the communists, they were mass hysteria too.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with true catastrophic consequences.
Indeed, yes, yes. Any movement can be captured by thugs, and that's what's happened.
So you've talked about the benefits of CO2.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a downside? Because there has to be. When we listen to the level of discourse about this, how can there not be some downside?
I don't think there are any real downsides. I mean, if you look at the arguments, the initial argument was there's going to be this rapid global warming. It hasn't happened. So it's very clear that the models have enormously exaggerated the warming potential.
Why has that happened? What is it about the models that when you simulate works and you say, well, there it is?
Well, I mentioned the saturation of CO2. You know, if you paint the barn red, if you put another coat, it's not any redder than it was before. And they noticed that early on, that CO2 has this problem that, you know, it's disappointing that it doesn't seem to make much difference if you add. So they invented all sorts of feedback mechanisms that would amplify the effect of additional CO2. Water vapor, clouds, all sorts of things were supposed to be triggered by the CO2. They don't seem to be happening.
But water vapor is a dominant greenhouse gas anyway.
Water vapor is the main greenhouse gas. Water vapor and clouds.
It is the greenhouse gas, isn't it?
Yeah, 70% maybe. Yeah.
I have talked to somebody else who is a climate scientist and said, no, clouds aren't in the equation. But how can they not be in the equation?
Well, it depends on the model. I mean, the most professional modelers, those trying to do the most honest job, do try to put in clouds, but it's very primitive, you know. It's a rough estimate. There's nothing.
My own journey with trying to understand climate science started when I watched Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth.
Yeah.
Mr. Gore says that if you take water vapor out of the equation, and he says it rather casually, if you take water vapor out of the equation, CO2 makes up 30% of greenhouse gases. And I went, holy smokes. So I started to do some investigation and went, okay, well, he's right about that, but you can't take water vapor out of the equation. And you can't, and if you do, are you then not negating the dynamic interaction between CO2, methane, water vapor, and the other greenhouse gases that are involved?
Yeah. No, of course you can't take water vapor out, and you should always be careful to say water vapor and clouds, and clouds. Clouds are big, big deal.
How come? What makes them a big deal?
Well, if you just go to space and look at the Earth, you don't see the ground over big fractions of the Earth. All you see is clouds.
But if you take a look, if you take a look at the Earth, that beautiful blue bubble or marble in space,
it's marble because the white part of the marble is clouds.
but that image that's on Al Gore's book doesn't show so much cloud cover as a result of global warming.
Well, yeah, that bothered Al, so he airbrushed a lot of the clouds out. You know, if you look at the original papers, they have many more clouds. I mean, I can show you if you like.
You say it's been airbrushed out?
Yes.
And what about the ice on the caps of the Earth, both the Antarctic and Arctic?
Antarctic ice is probably growing. You know, it's a big, complicated continent. West Antarctica, maybe there's a little decrease, but over most of Antarctica, it's increasing.
Well, I was just
sea
reading.
Ice is increasing around Antarctica.
Yeah.
That's not supposed to happen, you know, according to the model, but it is happening.
And what's happening in the Arctic?
Well, there's a good website, I think it's called Cryosphere or something, at the University of Illinois. And if you Google on it, you'll find it.
Cryosphere.
And they're pretty honest, I think. And so you can look at the ice this year or last year. And, you know, it fluctuates up and down. There's a lot of ice now because we're just coming out of the Arctic winter.
And a particularly cold one, too.
Yes, yes, yes. But the other thing to remember about the Antarctic, it's all water. It's completely different from the South Pole. You know, you've got this Arctic Ocean up there, which lets heat come in by warm water from the Atlantic in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of what's happening in the Arctic is really determined by ocean currents, not by the air temperature or things like that.
So over the course of the Earth's history, the ocean cycles and flow have played a significant role in temperature.
Still do. Yeah.
So here's one of the things that I hear when people try to explain the pause in increase in temperatures.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, well, it's because the Earth's oceans are absorbing that extra heat. And, of course, it is now circulating through the flow of the oceans, and this is why we're seeing melt not only in the Arctic, but in particular in Greenland. And yet, I read a report just last week released by NASA that said, nope, the deep ocean temperatures haven't changed at all.
It's hard for the deep ocean temperature to change much because, you know, the heat has to be convected down there. It won't conduct, you know, much too slow. So the only way to change the deep ocean is from water that is sinking up off Greenland or off the South Pole.
Yeah.
And those are very slow, measured currents that slowly, slowly move. And so it's extremely difficult to heat all of the ocean. It's quite easy to heat the first few inches, you know, or first few meters, you know, down to the thermocline, but it's much harder to get below that. So that has to be done by currents, which the other answer you should give when people say that is, well, if that's the case, why is it all these 70 models or whatever it is, you know, expensive computer models didn't predict that, you know? You know, they all promised they would predict what would happen to the temperature. You know, none of them got it right. Not only did they not get it right, they got it wrong by a huge amount, you know, factors 3, 4.
Do you have any sense of why that, how they could be, so many models could be so far off?
Well, yes, I mean, it was groupthink. The models never looked at the world. They looked at other models, and so they used to say, look how good we are, man. We're all getting the same answer. It must be right. You know, we're agreeing with each other. But then if you look at the models, they've all got different parameters. They've all been coded in different ways. And the reason they're giving the same answer is they look at each other and say, oh, I'll adjust this parameter and this one. And now it gives the same answer. And
so as we look to the future, are you hopeful that the world is going to continue to be a safe place, that we will do the things that are necessary to protect this precious planet, but the climate is not going to be the overwhelming catastrophic event that some people proclaim that it might be?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything to worry about from more CO2. I'll say it again, that I think more CO2 will be good for the world, that our great count children will look back and say, thank God we've got all this CO2, you know, what foresighted people our ancestors were. I think it is true that you can mess up the world very easily. You know, the American rivers used to be a disgrace. When I first went to New York City, you know, Hudson River was an open sewer, and it's clean now. There are salmon running up the river, the shad every spring. You know, and so that's the type of environmentalism that works and is good for us, and that's what we ought to be working on, cleaning up real things that make a difference.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate this. Thank you.
Pleasure. Yeah.
There you go. When they say that all these climate scientists have a consensus, that's not the truth at all. That's not even that's not even remotely close to the truth. But why is all this stuff important once again? It's important because you got governments out there regulating away people's rights and basically using fraudulent science to gather up more revenue. You know, they're flat out stealing from people. They're stealing from the world. They're stealing from developing nations that can't develop because of these so-called climate change regulations and laws that they put on people. But, you know, giving the devil his due, yes, if they say that there's a problem and there has been solutions available, there still are solutions available to re-engineer things to make things energy efficient, clean running. Even if you want to use what they call fossil fuel, which is a big lie, there is no such thing as fossil fuel. There never has been and never will be. But nonetheless, let's say they can have that. If you're going to run an internal combustion engine off of petroleum products, and you're not going to the extreme to ensure that you get a perfect burn every single time, and that whatever exhaust you have works as a filtration system, and you know, basically cleans up anything that didn't get you know, cleaned up. They're always talking about clean air emissions. They're always talking about, you know, like, you got to have a catalytic converter on your car. Well, what the heck is a catalytic converter? It's a reburner of waste fuel. Whatever doesn't get burned up in the intake through the, you know, the burn cycle or whatever, it gets sent out the exhaust valves, and then basically you lose heat and you lose fuel out the exhaust. And so, you know, with that said, if you want to go faster in your car, you have to push more fuel to it because of the inefficient way that they've engineered these things. And with that, you have to suck in more oxygen in order to be able to get that more fuel to burn efficiently enough to actually give you the power to run your vehicle down the road. But we have the technology to literally make this, you know, mathematically precise burn every single time, and use that power to where if you the faster you go, the less fuel you should have to use. But this is not why the industry does. Otherwise, you know, they would basically shoot themselves in the foot. The oil industry obviously needs to make money off of sales of oil, so they'll plan false scarcity of oil. They'll, you know, do all kinds of different things to jack the prices up at the pump. The governments will charge extra taxes for how many miles you drive or whatever. You know, you're breathing out CO2. So it's costing you just to breathe, which is pure ridiculousness. But even if they wanted to say carbon was the problem, we could get completely off of carbon-based and go strictly to hydrogen technology. And that would do the job right there. But it's not just that. There's other technologies available that's been around. The nuclear industry, which some people think we're all going to die from, because it's been put in their head for so many years how dangerous this was. But if that's the case, then this guy named Galen Windsor wasn't telling the truth back when he did the seminars about the nuclear industry. And, you know, I believe what he said. The government has really good reasons why they wouldn't want you to know that, radioactive material could basically solve the world's energy crisis overnight, even what they would classify as waste energy. You only get 2% of that radioactive rod to be used, then it won't boil the water fast enough at the most efficient rate in order to keep the steam turbines going. And it's essentially all we're doing is boiling water using the depleting radioactivity when that energy is basically shaking around the molecules of water and getting it hot. And when it gets down to a point where it doesn't do it efficiently, those are classified as waste material. When in reality, they're still producing energy. That energy could be used in all different types of thermoelectrics. Of course, they said they sent a probe all the way to Pluto, with a little, the thermal reactor using radioactive material that made it all the way through space, 9 years traveling through space, and had enough energy by the time it got to the other side to, light up Pluto, take a picture, and send that all the way back through the deep, dark space. This is what they said. This is their science, all right? So if they're telling you that has a capability of being able to do that, then what's the difference between boiling water and just using the thermal heat that's radiated from these radioactive rods to produce electricity? Most of the energy that we get comes from heat. Most of the time when you use an energy, it produces heat, vice versa. So heat plays a big factor in the deal. But you don't get the truth out of the system. The system has to keep certain things, under their hat, so to speak, kind of keep it secret, because if otherwise, then you wouldn't be paying an electric bill. You wouldn't be paying a fuel bill to drive your vehicle. Because if you knew the science and the physics of water, the water molecule, if you knew how to get the water to change its state and release its energy, then just like Stan Myers driving around in a dune buggy back in the 70s, running off of hydrogen technology. If you think about all the radio towers out there and the radio waves, and then you factor in how your actual microwave oven actually functions and cooks your food, you might be surprised at how much power there is available out there already. And, I keep saying this, if you can't find free energy, you simply haven't been paying attention to mad science. You ain't been looking hard enough, because we're surrounded in it. And that's one of the things that people like to say, you hear people all the time saying, we're still floating in a sea of energy. We are. Everything's energy. Water's energy. The doggone air you breathe is energy. Everything around you, including you, is energy. Everything could be used as a fuel. There ain't nothing, even a stone, even a rock, if you knew the physics of that rock, could be used as energy. But you don't get taught this stuff in science class. You don't get taught this stuff in college. All you get taught is fear-monger tactics to get these kids out there talking about how we're all going to die if we can't get our government to regulate this or regulate that, how we're going to save the planet. Well, I'm asking all the Save the Planet people, where are you? And seriously, and invited you to the table I don't know how many times. Every time I challenge anybody to a debate, they just disappear. They don't want no part of what I'm saying, because I'm talking truth. I'm talking about real science. I don't get into these shenanigans. If you're going to steal from people, I'm going to speak out against it. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're stealing people's education. They're stealing people's finances. They're just stealing from the future of humanity. If we got somebody in this world starving to death because they can't grow crops, because they can't get water to them, then what's the problem? Because we've got amazing pumping systems that could put water anywhere on the world that we want. And as far as, cleaning the water, if you understand the physics of water, then you understand exactly how to clean the water as well. You can purify water, you can take all the minerals out of water, and then you could turn around and you could put minerals right back in the water to match what nature's already done. But you don't get that. You don't get taught these things. If you're standing next to the ocean and you die of thirst, it's because you didn't pay attention in science class. Now, modern day science class will tell you you're doomed, because modern day science don't care to tell the truth anymore. You know, these teachers out there, for whatever, you know, good intentions they got, they say the road to disaster was paved by good intentions. Well, if you're sitting there teaching a lie just because it's your job or the government says, instead of questioning, if you're not questioning, then you're not practicing real science. A real science says that in this day and age, this 2019 that we're in, we have every single technology, every single piece of the puzzle necessary to resolve every single issue under the sun. And yet, we're not seeing it. So this is why mad science is so important. This is why I play these podcasts, because it's, you know, some people might think it's like beating a dead horse, but in reality, it's not beating a dead horse. It's beating the doggone truth out there into the public, because the public has been lied to and indoctrinated and propagandized to the extreme that they will literally fight the people who come in with the solutions. The alternative energy researchers out there that have all the answers necessary combined, put these systems together, and you've got the perfect running machines. And this is what they said. They said they needed clean, renewable, alternative energy. They needed storage. And it's right there. It's sitting on my lab table. It's sitting on some of these other alternative energy researchers' lab table. When are they going to put their money where their mouth is? If they waste all the money going to war, and they waste all their money with everything else, and even the protesters out there wasting their time and effort and money lobbying the system for something that's a false science to begin with, and getting absolutely no results, while at the same time trashing the environment because they leave behind tons of garbage and nasty stuff. You know, they don't clean up after themselves when they come out there and protest against the government. They're trashing the planet. And even the doggone Save the Trees, you know, people. If you're standing out there with a wooden stick and a paper sign, that's kind of hypocritical, wouldn't you think? But if you want to get results and you're not paying attention to solutions, then you're just starting trouble. You're not doing anything. If we're in as much danger as they like to claim we are, then why aren't they listening to guys like myself? We got all the answers. You know, they got the money, they got the machinery, they got the way that we could actually try it before you deny it. Build the doggone thing. If I'm saying you could engineer the perfect machine that would run on pure distilled water using all the known laws of physics, then why not build it? Why not try it out? The steam engine worked. Compression ignition worked. Induction heating works. Compressor technology, HVAC, works. Hydraulic technology works. Now you take all these things and then some, combine them together to the perfect machines, and they have all the finances and the researchers available to literally build these machines to prove to the world once and for all what I've been saying, and what the real science has been saying all along. But you're not going to get that, because the system, the lobbyists of the system, the special interest groups of the world, they don't want you to have free energy. They don't want you to have it. They want to be able to charge you every time you flip that light switch on your doggone wall there. They want to charge you every time you go to the gas pump. But at the same sense, they want to appease the one who want to save the planet and charge you more for your fuel and energy needs. And it's ridiculous. It's flat out ridiculous. When there is a way to solve the issue at hand, there's always been a way to solve. We've had doggone solution before the problem was ever even contemplated on. But you can't use real science. You can't use real truth. Truth is a lie. Truth is the new lie. If you tell the truth about things, somebody's going to come out and call you a denier. They want to call you a hypocrite. And they put little children out there to spread propaganda And then if you say that little children's misquoting what the laws of physics or science proclaim to begin with, then you're a meanie. You're a terrible guy because you're talking bad. You're saying this child, you know, doesn't know what the child's talking about. Maybe you can send that kid back to school and teach him real science for once. You know? But playing on your heartstrings and ripping people off and being a hypocrite and saying that we need to fix something when not doing anything about it, that's where I draw the line. That's where mad science draws the line. So anyway, I'm going to play a little bit of what Galen Windsor was talking about. I'm going to kind of start a little after the nuclear scare scam video, because the nuclear scare scam video, it's pretty long, pretty lengthy, but it's worth looking into. I posted the links over to ShazizRadio.com in the super chat room, so you can, all these video podcasts that I've played, you can go back and listen to them if you missed anything or are interested in hearing. And that's the thing, you know, if you join us on the chat room, it's great for you to, where it's encouraged for you to post links of good information that's going to be helpful to people. That's what it's all about here. And even to the extent as if you want to get on the radio show with me, you know, just add me as a contact on your Skype, and then you'd be able to call in and join me on the show. Tell me where you think I'm wrong. Tell me where you think that, you know, we're in danger or whatever. But I haven't found one person who can come to me with an honest debate that isn't willing to just, when their facts don't add up, they just want to start calling me names and being hateful and rude about it. No, we're going to be respectful when we do this. But the truth is the truth, no matter how you look at it. But today, in today's upside down or inside out or sideways society, the truth seems to be a lie. The truth is what they want to suppress. They want to suppress anybody who has a dissenting or opposite view of what the, you know, the so-called loudmouths or elitist of the world want. They want to keep you enslaved. They want to keep you paying money. They want to keep control over you, and that's what this is all about. And this little next little podcast, that'll give you some kind of insight. When you talk about the nuclear power industry, the nuclear power industry has got a pretty much a bad reputation, you know, under basically wrong circumstances. I'll go more into that later. This is from 1985.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here with you this evening. Did you know that you are paying 10 times too much for your electricity, and that if you used existing technology, you could have it at a price that whoever generated it could ill afford to meter it, because we just flat rate it into your homes at, say, $20 a month? The key to prosperity is to get the government out of the energy regulating business. Insight into why we are overregulated with absurd standards are going to be developed during this talk. And we're going to make some suggestions that we, you, me, can do to regain prosperity. Question: should the public be concerned about safety of nuclear power? The answer is very simple. No. It is inherently safe. The media is misrepresenting the case. The media comes out and they... articles like this on the front page of the Argonian on Mother's Day. A Hanford worker with his mask and his coveralls, a diagram of putting what they call high-level waste 3,200 feet deep into solid basalt. What they have labeled waste are the plutonium resources of the future. Should we talk about a reactor to which people are often exposed? The sun is an operating thermonuclear reactor, 93 million miles away, far enough away that the energy it deposits on the Earth is 1 kilowatt on 1 square meter in an hour. One of those neat ones, and you can always remember that. So when somebody tells you that the sun's good for you, you have to believe them because it sustains all life on Earth. If they tell you that looking at the sun without colored glasses, in other words, with a naked eye, 10 seconds, if you stare at that sun not in an eclipse, it will burn the retina of your eye. Multiple exposures to the sun can cause cancer, does cause cancer. If you lie naked on the desert long enough, it will kill you. And yet, as I walked past the swimming pool just a little while ago, there were sunbathers out there. Minimum of attire, shielding, if you will, absorbing energy from the sun, that reactor up in the sky. And this reactor burns the skin, otherwise the skin would not suntan. Suntan is just like good cooking. It's a controlled burn. And the sunbathers and you and I have no fear of the sun. Those of us who get exposed to the sun realize that a white shirt and a cowboy hat are all that is required to keep us from getting burned. And if we want more sun, we just roll up our sleeves and pick up a little brown on the arms. May I submit, at this stage, nuclear reactors are no different. They give off the same kinds of energy, and they're useful for the same purpose. The only thing that makes them different is that they have a higher power density. How can nuclear radiation harm you? Will it hurt you? Yes. If it comes from an atomic blast, if it comes from an unshielded nuclear reaction, or if it is in the hands of a doctor. Otherwise, it's pretty acceptable. An atomic blast. When we say this, well, you see the Hiroshima and Nagasaki mushroom clouds. Did you know that 18 Japanese civilians survived Hiroshima, made their way to Nagasaki, and survived that one also 3 days later? One of these guys was a Japanese newspaper editor, and he went to the mayor of Nagasaki and he says, those Yanks have really got something this time. They've got a bomb that announces itself with a flash of light. And if you hurry and get something between you and that flash, you can survive. The Japanese, in less than 3 days, had learned a lesson that we have not yet learned in 40 years. This lesson is, briefly, stop looking at the blast, drop down and make as small a target out of yourself as you can in a ditch behind a rock, and roll under something if it's available to keep debris from falling upon you. Great big debris, the kind that will crush you and snuff out your life. This story was told to the policeman in Nagasaki. Do you know how many people were policemen were injured at Nagasaki or killed? None. They listened, heard the story once, and they took action, protected themselves. The police chief's son and three companions were on their way to school at 8:15 that morning. The boy saw the flash, grabbed one of his companions, and dove into a shelter. The other two boys stood there gawking and were blown away, never seen again. There are the quick and the burn. Light travels at 186,000 miles per second. When you've seen it, you've had it. The nuclear radiation from an atomic blast, when you've seen it, you've had it. there's not any more of any consequence coming. Sound travels at sea level about 750 miles per hour. That's roughly a mile and 5 seconds. So coming behind the light flash at the speed of sound is a heat and pressure wave that's hot, in excess of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It's going to burn anything that gets in its way unless something deflects it over you. May I submit that what they're doing in Russia right now is a pretty good trick. A fallout shelter, a blast shelter, or whatever you want to call it in Russia, is just a slope-sided trench with railroad ties across it, not spaced so closely that you can't run and dive headlong into this thing to protect yourself. If the flash of light is 2 miles away, you have only 10 seconds to take cover. Would you volunteer to take 11? Wouldn't be too wise. 5? Yeah, that'd be about right, because you could keep your head down. How long are you going to keep your head down? You consult the Army training manual, and it says that after the echo waves subside, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, bounces back and forth a few times, and there's a thunder and lightning and a great deal of fuss. But when that part of it is over, you get up and go do your assigned duty. That's what the Army training manual says. It only says one thing that's inconsistent, and it's fed into it by the Health Physics Society. It says, record your dose. I will submit that it is recorded on the human dosimeter, and that if you don't have a suntan, a burn, you don't have a problem. Unshielded nuclear reaction. The record is not perfect. This chart shows you that there have been 34 accidents from unshielded nuclear reactions in this country up to 1967. This is recorded in Los Alamos document 3611. In 6 of these accidents, 8 people died. Now, on the chart, it only shows 5 deaths. Those are the red lines that go below the horizontal axis, representing deaths, of course, from burns. Where's 3 of them? 3 of them died at SL1 in Idaho in the 1950s when one guy pulled the control rods manually out of an Army test reactor. The thing went critical, developed steam pressure, and drove the control rods like harpoons through them and stuck them to the overhead. So they don't count as radiation burn deaths because they didn't die from radiation burns. They died from being harpooned. General Electric Company, for whom I worked 26 years, went in and decommissioned that site so that it just looked like a patch of sand and gravel in Idaho. The first reactor decommissioning. And what a miserable thing to do. Why did they do it? So that they'd never be reminded of their failure to maintain control of the nuclear genie. Now, this nuclear genie is pretty fierce. You let it get out of control, and it can burn you. 5 of those guys died from real accidents. One of them was tickling the dragon's tail, taking half of a critical mass in one hand and half in another, and on a ratchet device, figuring out how close you can get them together before you get a blue flash. He got a blue flash all right, but he was sitting fumbling with a screwdriver trying to get them apart. And this blue flash, in a millisecond, can burn you. In the millisecond that the thing was in critical position, it was trying to drive itself apart, but because he had it on a ratchet device, it wouldn't. So it burned him badly. He walked away and he said, if I'd had a quick release on that thing, it wouldn't have burned me. 39 hours later, he was dead. He walked away knowing that he was going to die. The first one. And the second one was taking little cubes of enriched fuel material and building what he thought was a geometric shape that would do the job. And he was building a cube with cubes and he had this thing build up, and he came over with one cube and dropped it accidentally into the middle. That was the magic one. It went critical. It exceeded the amount of material that had to be so that you could get neutrons absorbed and make an unlimited chain reaction. The air in the room turned blue. There were other people in the room. He thought, because the one that he dropped had made it go critical, he took the time to go after the one that was in the middle. It was very hot. It took time. How would he supposed to have stopped the reaction? And he realized that later. All he had to do was hit the whole stack with the heel of his hand, and it had gone away. That meant that he didn't even have to run away from it. 40 hours later, he was dead. We could go on to the other accidents, but the point is, you mishandle the nuclear genie, and he'll kill you. The safety record for this is not perfect. Those who pretend that it is are the ones that say that 50-plus people kill building wasting towers. They call them cooling towers. I call them wasting towers at a reactor. Were killed in one fell swoop when a scaffold broke. And they said that didn't have anything to do with nuclear power. Oh, it didn't? That's the device that the opposition used to throw over 50% of the heat away without using it. You bet it has to do with this thing. And they killed over 50 men one afternoon. They don't talk about it, do they? The sun can burn. All you got to do is go out there without a white shirt on, and it'll burn you. Repeated exposures can cause cancer. Except that daily exposure is required for good health. What are you then going to do about Navy nuclear submariners who run submerged for months on end? What are they going to do? They have in a package a reactor that two of us could reach around, fueled with fully enriched uranium, and this thing is fueled so that it will last for the expected operational life of that undersea boat, 17 to 20 years. It will run at speeds in excess of 35 knots submerged, and they depend upon it for their light, their heat, their mobility, their air, their water, and their suntans. And to get a suntan, all you have to do is hook up a sun lamp, or if they didn't put so cotton-picking much shielding on that reactor, they could just walk up to the reactor and kind of sunbathe in it to get their ultraviolet light. Now, doctors. Doctors burn people to cure cancer in cobalt therapy centers. If it doesn't burn, they don't cure cancer. I have a sheet of paper here of a Federal Register where they gave a person who had just had a lung removed 5 shots. They were to give them 5 shots of 400 R each. Now look on the chart to realize how much 400 is, and realize that the scale is marked off in logarithmic functions. 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000. A doctor exposes people in the 7,000 to 10,000 Rontgen range to burn cancer cells preferentially because they are faster growing than normal cells. At that point, you say, on this experiment, 5 doses of 400 R each. They made a computer mistake. Instead of giving all 5 doses at 400, they gave 2 at 400 and 3 at 800 R each for a total accumulative dose of 3200 R instead of 2000. The NRC held a special safety investigation. Their doctor says that there were no significant observable effects on that patient of increase in individual doses by a factor of 2 and the cumulative dose from 2,000 to 3,200. And that the NRC reviewed it and found out that their report was quite correct. There were no significant effects. Then I submit there was no cure. Because unless they burned that body, there was no effect. In 1967, I attended a seminar in Berkeley that was taught by Bob Stewart from across the bay. Can't even think of the name of the university. Stanford. And Bob had some pictures of women who had been treated for uterine cancer with strong bursts of gamma energy delivered in a short time, the point that they would burn. And there were several women in the group, and we just had a fine buffet dinner. And when the women saw these pictures, a good fraction of them went outside and regurgitated their food because it made them ill just to look at the burned purple skin on these women who had had cancer cured. Now, since gamma is preferentially absorbed in the skin on the surface, like suntans now, and because it's the shortest wavelength, highest frequency of the ultraviolet spectrum, then if you get enough dose deep enough in the body to burn, you're going to burn the skin, maybe even turn it purple, to cure what's deeper inside the body. If you don't want to do it that way, then you go to radium implants like the old doctors used to, and I find out that some of them still today use that technique. Now, you can get burned how? In an atomic blast, in an unshielded nuclear reaction, or at the hands of a doctor, for which you get to pay with the approval of the Federal Drug Administration and the American Medical Association. What about if you're a non-nuclear worker, just ordinary people, around an island like Three Mile Island in the Susquehanna River in near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania in 1979? Should you be afraid? The media went in there and blew that thing entirely out of proportion. They had people evacuating as far away as New York City to get away from that. And yet, I submit that Jimmy Carter and his wife, going there a week later, did not display courage. If it was as bad as to have all the people that lived around the island evacuating, what was the President of the United States doing in that control room? The stage show on TV called Saturday Night Alive saw through that whole sham. The writers wrote the Pepsi syndrome. Remember it? They had it. It was all pretense. There is nothing wrong with that reactor that a skilled, dedicated crew couldn't have turned around in 2 to 6 weeks and put it back online. In April of 1979, 6.5 years later, almost, it's still offline. Sitting next to it was Three Mile Island 1, a perfectly operable reactor down for refueling. It's still down for refueling. It's been fully staffed, fully fueled, fully operable for 6.5 years, and it's never generated any power. It's a net consumer of power and dollars, roughly $1 million a day for TMI-1, another $1 million a day for TMI-2 for 6.5 years. Somebody figure that out for me and tell me what it is. It's a whole lot of dollars. Do you know how they replace the power? They buy it from Ontario Hydro in Canada at 80% of their cost of generation and sell it for 120 to 125% of what it would cost them, with the approval of their public utility commission. How can they afford to leave two reactors already operationally tested down for 6.5 years? Good question, isn't it? On that particular point, the company for which I worked, E.J. Crosby & Associates, volunteered to go in and pull the core on that reactor, lay it out on the deck, because 6.5 years later you can handle it barehanded. Just lay it out on the deck and demonstrate to the world that there's nothing wrong with that reactor. I made that observation that that was the case in 1979 to Battelle Memorial Institute, for whom I worked at the time. They said, oh no, 20% of that core is just mangled. No. They took the head off that reactor on the 24th of July last year. They looked down into perfectly clear water, and guess what they saw? a reactor that hadn't been physically damaged at all, other than to have a few fuel pins burst. It's not melted. The fuel is removable. And so I'm going to go to Congress and say to them, if that fuel is like I said it was 6 years ago, remotely replaceable, I get to keep the fuel. You need to give me a few million dollars to pay for this little exercise, and you need to give me permission to go in there and do it. My company, E.J. Crosby, and I have access to the Lower Columbia Basin Search and Rescue Unit, 15 trained scuba divers, and we'll go in there and we'll pull that fuel out by hand, this long since shutdown, and put it in buckets, if that's where you want to see it. That we get to keep the fuel, and if it's really like I say it is, we get to keep the whole island. And if we have the whole island, we'll show you how to run it. How will we run it? At 100% available power. In other words, run it over nameplate rating enough days out of the year that while we're down for refueling, it still won't put it below 100%. If you think that the island is too contaminated, we'll turn on the fire hose and flush it down like the Navy does its ships at sea. Wow. Can you imagine what trouble I'm going to get into when I go to Congress with that one? Now, ultraviolet light energy is preferentially absorbed in the skin. If you ingest it, it's supposed to burn you, be harmful to you. In Brazil, tomatoes grow on monzonite sands that have high thorium content. It turns out that these tomatoes, if you slice them, they come from Brazil, and you lay them down on a film packet, they'll take their own radio autograph. Does that sound like what that neat woman, Marie Curie, did a few decades ago? That's what she did. She had a rock like this, and she laid it next to some film, and when she developed the film, it was smudged because it had been close to a rock like this. Marie Curie did that a number of years ago. Here we are, all of these decades later, hanging film badges around radiation workers to tell when they've had too much exposure. Oh, isn't that great? Can you imagine what happened in the fall of 76 when I went back to Hanford after running an ore buying station in Colorado where we handled rocks like this every day, and I didn't take my pet rock out of my pocket, and they hung one of their film badges on? We burnt that film badge rock in less than a week. Who had the highest exposure in Hanford on the fall of 76? I did. You know what they did? They assembled an August review board of five managers, and they decided that since I didn't get that exposure doing work out there, that they'd write my total whole body exposure for 25 years of work to zero. I interrogated the computer, and that's the way it came out. Okay. There's a story available, I hope it got passed out, on They Also Serve, which is the effect of hanging these kind of dosimeters around somebody's neck and saying, go maintain that reactor. I'm going to tell you that such things as that are ridiculous. Now, this chart over here says that 60 R per hour delivered to living human cells, the human cells self-repair during the time of exposure. Those who don't make it die. Those who self-repair live. Then I'll submit that 60 R per hour is the lower level of concern. The federal regulation is 60 micro R per hour for off-site dose from a reactor. That's a million times less than that that has no effect on human cells. Then we rapidly get to the conclusion that the federal safety regulations are absurd. They are meaningless, except that they cost us free use of the nuclear option. They are a billion times too conservative. To which I say, Our ability to measure has exceeded our ability to understand. If you haven't been burned, what is your problem? We go back to the standard that was in existence before 1934, before the International Commission on Radiation Protection, headquarters in Vienna, Austria, imposed a standard that says X-ray handling, gamma ray handling, can no longer be allowed to burn anyone. We're going to install a standard of 0.2 R per day. How much is 0.2 R per day? It's less than 1/1,000,000,000 of 1 calorie, of which we probably ate over 1,000,000 for lunch today. You say, no, I just ate 1,000 calories for lunch today. No, I say that you ate 1,000 kilocalories for lunch today, large C, not lower C. And these people then want to regulate the radiation that comes from materials that are used in a reactor to less than 1/1,000,000 of the food content that you ate today for lunch. Heat equivalent. Aren't they nice people? What are they doing? They're using technical razzle-dazzle to confuse you because you don't understand orders of magnitude, powers of 10, and exponential functions. The safety standards have been set at the level of detection, not at the level of hazard. And we've let them get away with it. Them? Who? The majority of the Congress, all of the people in the bureaus of the government. Well, I had this figured out a long time ago, and last December I was working on cutting up a steam generator that should have been cut up in Virginia 6 years ago, and I had a neat tool that would do it, and I had my crew of men working at it out at 300 area in Hanford, and I was making it look so easy that Battelle, Pacific Northwest Laboratory managers, decided they would conspire against me. So I took one of my tools back to the shop. It was contaminated with cobalt-60, but in a exempt quantity. In other words, if you got an exempt quantity of cobalt-60, which is a microcurie, if a piece that you have is less than that, then you can do anything you want, including eat it. I can't even talk tonight. Anyway, I took that tool to the shop and worked on it, and I brought it back out to the plant, and the plant manager saw it the next morning, and he says, "Where's that tool been?" I said, "It's been in my shop. Isn't that the one I saw downstairs yesterday?" I said, "Yes, it is." He says, "For that, I shut the job down, I cancel your contract, and I'm throwing you off site." For what? Less radioactivity than on a watch dial. But it came from his plant, and what it was I was in danger of exposing their fraud, their deception. They're spending $10 million to sample that steam generator, which wasn't needed in the first place, in Richland, in a special building, a fortress built so that they could control the radioactivity, and it could have been sampled in a tent on the beach in Virginia 6 years ago and accomplished the same thing. Exposure to radioactivity, indeed. I was exposing them to the bright light of sunshine, and they didn't like it. Anyway, they sent a couple of radiation monitors and a manager down to my shop to survey for cobalt-60. And I'm a rascal. I walked in with a bottle of uranium oxide like this, and I said, poured some of it out in my hand like this. Well, we got to play a couple of games first. See what it counts through the bottle? Gamma is supposed to be the most penetrating of all radiation. Is it? That glass bottle is holding it out. Look what happens when I tip it over to the lid without the plastic on top. Most penetrating of all radiation? It can't even get out of a glass bottle. You see? I poured some out in my hand like this. And I said, survey it. And I stuck it out in front of their Geiger counter, and their Geiger counter went off third scale like mine just did. And then I smeared it all over where they were surveying. And he complained. And I says, don't complain to me. You got 100,000 times more than you had before. Just get back to your survey. And I poured some out in my hand like this, and we got into a tiff about whether ingestion of it would hurt. And I did differently than I'm going to do now, but and I swallowed it. And I splashed it all over my face, so I got it in my lungs and in my eyes. And I said, what's wrong with you people? Have you lost your mind? It blew their mind. They took off out of there like scalded apes. Anyway, radioactive material outside its container is radioactive contamination. You got that? If you scoop it back up, then I just decontaminated Galen Windsor's hand. The amount of radioactivity that I have on my hand is a reportable incident in Hanford, Washington. The Department of Energy says if it's detectable, we have to report it to the newspapers. There are several ways to get that off my hand. One of them is to wash it, but if you wash it, it has to go down a controlled drain according to the federal regulations. I'm going to ask the question, do I qualify as a controlled drain? Must be. Now, the difference between high-level waste and low-level waste. High-level waste is self-heating. It's detectable on a Geiger counter. I submit that I am not low-level waste because I am self-heating and I am radioactive. The federal regulations require that high-level waste be buried 3,200 feet deep in basalt. Now do you know why, when I did this at Hanford, that they turned out a federal SWAT team to get me on orders of the NRC in Walnut Creek, California, NRC Region 5, Bob Thomas by name, issued a federal warrant for my arrest. And so the SWAT team came out with a picture, and you know, it's not too hard to find a picture of Galen Windsor. They even got him in trim bulletins nowadays. It said on there, this is an irrational individual. He poses a threat to our security. Take him at any cost. How did I pose a threat to their security? I was taking a hot sword called truth, and I just poked it in their hot air balloon. And their fraud was about to be exposed, and that worried them. The state of Washington sent two of their Gestapo agents, they call them radiation protection people, those that would keep us from using the nuclear genie, over to audit Battelle's survey. They came into my home and they said, we are here to confiscate your uranium. And I said, after I'd given them a little demonstration, the only way that you'll ever get to touch my uranium samples again is with a court order. They went to get the court order. They never got it. I told their boss where to go via my state representative, Ray Isaacson, who had been handling uranium and plutonium and fission products with me for 35 years. Ray's been fighting a losing battle in the legislature in Washington, and I've been fighting a losing battle in Illinois for years. Ray took the position a long time ago that low-level waste are just ordinary material. If they are less than economically recoverable amounts, then you just flush them down the sewer or throw them away in the dump. He did that in 1981 in the state legislature, made a big presentation on it, got all kinds of backing, and they never did anything with it. And the next year, he never even made the presentation because somebody got to him and hit him over the head and says, uh-uh, you don't do that. Now, let me tell you a story about low-level waste. If you declared it non-hazardous, and just threw it away like that, all you'd have to do is sit still and listen to see who howls the loudest. The truckers who get paid for hauling it across country at 32 cents a ton mile, which is a fair rate of pay, incidentally. That's what it was 5 years ago. I don't know what it is now. Or the people who conceal legal evidence in 55-gallon drums by hanging a radioactive sign on the side, yellow and magenta, filling out a radioactive shipment record by one RSO, radiation safety officer, and dumping it into a federally mandated non-inspectable system. I'll tell you that organized crime uses that of getting away from their evidence, from that would convict them. It outmodes concrete overshoes in the Chicago River by a whole great big bunch. Low-level waste is a tool of those who oppose progress in total. They're backed up by a legal system and regulations that don't make any sense. Proliferation control of weapons. Remember when the Israelis took out a reactor in Iraq? They had fully enriched U-235 supplied by France, and they were accused of going to take that fully enriched uranium, put it into a reactor, convert it into plutonium. They were going to recover the plutonium and make weapons out of it. Now, anybody that believes that that's what Iraqi was going to do with that fully enriched uranium doesn't know that fully enriched uranium makes a better weapon than plutonium does. I will submit that 4 years ago over South Africa, that flash over Madagascar was a fully enriched uranium bomb made by the South Africans by laser isotopic enrichment techniques. And a South African can do it. Anybody else can. They're a slightly disorganized nation. They got political problems. If they can gather up the resources to make a fully enriched U-235 weapon, then where does Jimmy Carter get off saying you can transfer fully enriched U-235 to India, but you can't transfer them any plutonium, because if they get plutonium, they'll make a weapon out of it. Ridiculous. Now, if you're going to control bombs in the hands of terrorists, then obviously you're going to ban all of the uranium on Earth and all of the lasers. Because anybody that knows the activation energy of U-235 as compared to U-238 can gather up the material to make a weapon. I know where there's pet rocks like this. This one's 16% uranium. In northwest Saskatchewan, just laying on the surface of the ground where you can dig them with a front-end loader, and that's where France gets its uranium.
Well, pause this just for a second, because it's been a long time since these videos actually came out, and there were people saying that Galen Windsor died of leukemia because of eating radioactive material. But if you look at the actual age he was whenever he died, he was supposed to die at the age of 82, and so he's nowhere near 82 in this video, and while eating radioactive material still manages to live to be 82 years old. That ought to say something. And you know, so with that said, if nuclear power was as dangerous as what they said, he wouldn't have never done this video. But it's neither here nor there. There's so many different ways in order to utilize energy in such a much more efficient and incredible manner that it's mind blowing. So why would the governments out there want to not let you know that what they're burying in the ground could potentially solve the so-called energy crisis and isn't in fact actually waste? Matter of fact, it's probably worth a whole heck of a lot of money, which in one of these two videos that I posted out here, he actually gets into about why, what would be their purpose of not allowing. He's sort of talking about part of it right now, so let's go ahead and continue for a bit.
Got an article here that says that uranium is in short supply. Don't waste it. By 1965, we had enough uranium stacked as UF6 at Paducah, Kentucky, to last us from now on. It was 1975 when I was running a uranium ore buying station, and I couldn't figure out why GE gave me $6 million just to buy uranium when there was already enough out of the ground. That's when I found out about an international cartel called NewExco, Nuclear Exchange Company, that regulated the price of uranium worldwide. And when I wanted to find out how much to pay the uranium miners over there, I called San Jose, and they would tell me what the NewExco price was. And one time I called in and I says, what's the NewExco price now? What am I paying my miners? And they said, Ken Hawes, whom I went to college with in 1950, passed the phone over to a NewExco guy, and he says, here, ask him. In other words, I had the head man on the phone calling from Colorado to find out what I was supposed to spend GE's money on. I had a sneaking feeling that I was in a sneaky business. I decided to get out, and so I resigned and went home. Okay, several myths. This pet rock won't burn you. But federal regulations, 10 CFR 61, says it has to be buried 30 feet deep so that a stumbler prospector 100 years from now won't find it and get burned. Now, if it won't burn you now, how's it going to burn you 100 years from now or somebody else? It won't be you or it won't be me, because we're not going to be around. How would it burn them then if it won't burn now? If gamma is the most penetrating of all radiation, how come it doesn't count? How come it doesn't count very much as compared to how it counts right there? You suppose they've been lying to you? They've been misrepresenting about this energy that comes off here? I'll bet you they have. You've heard it said that 5 grams of plutonium properly distributed over the face of the earth will kill everybody on earth. Well, I doubt it. I took this out of a film can. Let's put it back in and turn the counter on again. Doesn't count very much, does it? That's the reason you put film in a can, is to keep it from being exposed from gamma activity. You'll find out the Department of Transportation rules say you got to protect film and people to the same standard. That's ridiculous. They've got people limited to what they ship film in, and they put film in cans like this. What they're really saying is to ship people on airplanes, you got to put them in cans like this too. Is it radioactive? When I get it out and count it, it's not radioactive, it's very radioactive. It has a density of 19. There are two elements that have density 19. One of them is uranium, the other is plutonium. And I submit that outside of a laboratory, you can't tell whether this is uranium, plutonium, or a mixture of the two. Is it pyrophoric? Yeah, it is. Pyrophoric means that I can strike sparks off it. Those hot particles that were flying around there was reactor fuel melting, burning. And if it's plutonium, I just contaminated this area right here in excess of the EPA's limit for 1 square mile. Go tell the NRC on me. Say that I've broken the EPA's limit. I'm going to climb on an airplane in the morning and go home, and I'm going to have this thing in my wallet. What then? I've just broken the federal regulations, because it says as you go on to past the security point there that radioactive materials are hazardous in any amount. There are no amounts designated. And when I carry Mion, because I've been eating uranium, I'm also forbidden. I'm breaking the federal regulations. What are they going to do? If they know it, they're going to fine me $10,000 and put me in jail for a year. And I've been doing it for 14 months on lecture tour. If it's a year per occasion, I'm in deep trouble. What am I telling you? That the federal regulations are ridiculous, absurd. In my hand, Coleman gas mantles. Did you know they were radioactive? Someone said the other day, if Galen Windsor's got them, we know they're radioactive. What do you do with a Coleman gas mantle? Well, you put it on a lantern, and you light a match to it, turn on the gas and light another match, and heat it up to white incandescence. And if, while it's off, the children reach their hands in and macerate the mantle, what you do is you whop the children on the bottom, complain about the cost of putting a new mantle on, and go through the same process again. But nobody goes and washes the child's hand because they've got radioactive material on them, thorium oxide. Back to our story. Is radioactive fallout harmful to you? Remember how long you stay down? Till after the echo waves stop bouncing. What about the stuff that falls from the sky? Any problem? No, not really. Because it's oxide created at white incandescent temperatures. So oxides are not soluble. This stuff that's on my hand is known in the industry as HCl insoluble. That means that it won't dissolve in concentrated hot hydrochloric acid. In your stomach you have 10th normal hydrochloric acid. This stuff will not dissolve in body fluids. It has a biological half-life of about 2 days. And then it's all gone. Even though it has a radioactive half-life of 4 billion years. Does it hurt me to eat it? Not at all. Does it hurt the NRC for me, have me eat it? Yeah, it does, because it exposes their fraud. You know what NRC means, don't you? That's the no reactor crowd. The rules are set, the standards are set by the EPA. Let me give you another definition for EPA. It means the end of progress altogether. They say that a hazardous material in any amount located any place must be removed at great public expense. If asbestos causes lung cancer, then you can go in at great public expense and tear it out of your schools. Make dust out of it again when all you had to do was coat it with paint or plastic and leave it there to do its job. How many schools have been torn into just to get rid of asbestos? What then are you going to do with the mountain where this rock came from? It's asbestos. If I flick dust off from it, is it going to cause lung cancer? No, not unless you get it into your lungs repeatedly, time after time. I was in a supply house back east when they were served a federal warrant on a $5 million lawsuit because they had sold tape with asbestos in it to the United States Nuclear Navy. Tell me that lawyers didn't kill the nuclear option. Lead, that stuff they put in gasoline to keep it from knocking, pre-detonating, is harmful in any amount. What are you going to do? When I was just 14 years old, I found this rock 1,400 feet underground in Fioch, Nevada. It's called Galena, just like my first name, only with an A on it. 95% lead. Will it hurt you? Not unless it enters your body in a form like this in excess of 2,000 feet per second. It's the suddenness of the impact that makes the difference, not the material. This piece of lead my son took out of a human body and gave to me. That's called dying of lead poisoning. May I submit at this point that the only reportable events are deaths, not fractional deaths, are those from which you recovered. What did we do with those black figures on there that were exposed to unshielded nuclear reactions? What do you do with them in your society? Cross them off? Are they high-level waste? Because they are self-heating, and they were radioactive to a certain extent. The radioactivity could be measured on a Geiger counter. That's how you determine how much medical attention you're going to give them. What are you going to do with the people that survived? What did you do with the 34 people that didn't die? You never answered that question. Neither has society. The Department of Energy ramrodded the Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982 through the United States Congress. It is Public Law 97-425. This requires a mill per kilowatt hour on all nuclear power. That's a dollar per megawatt hour. At Rancho Seco, that means that that's $913 an hour, has to go to the Secretary of Energy so that you can research how to throw away plutonium. Now, plutonium is the reason why we built reactors at Hanford in the first place, and it's the reason why I came to California in 1965 to do the detailed design work on this plant, which we later built in Illinois. They told me that I got to build it down at San Luis Obispo, and that's how they got me away from Hanford in the first place. But we didn't get to build it at San Luis Obispo. We built it at Morris, Illinois. Why do you build plants like this? Obviously, to recover plutonium from the uranium matrix in which it is created. The federal government right now has said that you got to bury this stuff 3,200 feet deep in solid rock. And they've got contests going on between states to find out whether you're going to bury it in basalt or granite or salt. Somebody's stupid. Do you suppose it is stupidity? Or do you suppose it is a plot? I suspect it's a plot. For 57 years out of my life, I thought that I could make this thing come up right because I was right and for no other reason. And then there was a neat little guy from Germany, Hans Phillips, who was drafted into the German army when he was 15, and drafted into our army when he was 25. And he got hold of me one day, and he set me down, and he taught me a few basics about the difference between a democracy and a republic. I didn't really understand, because I was just a neutron mechanic that knew how to make plutonium out of uranium. And Hans Philipp got my attention. About the time he got my attention, and after I'd had time for it to soak in, there was another guy came on the scene. His name's Alan Stang. And he came into my home, and I was trying to convince Alan about what I knew, and he was trying to tell me what to do about it, and we did this for 3 hours, and finally Alan says, "Galen, I know the answer to your problem." "What is it, Alan?" He says, "Easy. Go on lecture tour for American Opinion Speakers Bureau, and by the time you get done, you'll have it figured out." Thanks a lot, Alan. Goodbye. Well, Alan Stang is a neat guy, and he doesn't give up easily, not even on characters like me. And one day my wife said to me, "Aren't you glad that we are not our grandchildren?" I said, "What'd you say, woman?" "Say it again." So she did. "Aren't you glad that we're not our grandchildren?" Now, I've got 5 of the neatest grandchildren in the whole world. They're the cutest, best behaved, neatest little grandchildren you've ever seen. The youngest, you know what her first word that she ever spoke was? "Grandpa." you think she can get me to do what she wants me to do? When she was 2 and a half, she came up and I was resting in my chair, and she grabbed me by the finger and she says, "Grandpa, vroom, vroom." I says, "Ariel, it's 10 o'clock at night. No, we're not going on the motorcycle." And she grabbed me by the finger and says, "Grandpa, vroom, vroom." 5 minutes later, we were going down the street, and she was honking the horn on that 550 Honda, and happy as could be. Why was she honking the horn? So that the neighbors would know that she had her grandfather in tow at 10 o'clock at night. I would do anything in the world for my grandchildren. Even call Joe Mertens and tell him that I would go on lecture to her for American Opinion Speakers Bureau. It's not easy to go on lecture to her. They keep me away from home for 3, 4, 5 weeks at a time, and they don't think anything of it. And guys like Tom Gow, you know what he did to me the other day? He put me on the air with Jim Eason on KGO, and he sat there and smiled all the time that he did it. Now, he presumed that I could get myself out of trouble, keep myself out of trouble with Jim Eason. That's not easy. You heard the story in the Bible about Daniel being thrown to the lion's den? That isn't what Tom Gow does. He throws Gale into Jim Eason. Well, it works. If you know what you're talking about, if you have truth as a weapon, there's no problem. Truth. Dose rates that deposit ultraviolet energies on the skin won't burn you and keep your blood from repairing any damage done to the skin. Now, my neighbor John Nelson is a really fine radiomicrobiologist. He found out that if you shield some of the rats' tails with lead and put all of the rats in the same radiation field, that the rats that weren't shielded die and the ones that had lead-shielded tails live. You're going to have to think about that one for a while, and while you're thinking about it, I'm going to go on. Before we had instruments, we used to work until we got burned. And we used to go to first aid every once in a while, and we'd hold our hands out like this. And if the nails weren't shriveling a little bit and wrinkling a little bit, why, they'd say, "Okay, go back to work." Before we had instruments. After we got instruments, then we had to keep the 0.2 hours per day standard. Let's talk about something else. Why do we have these absurd standards? I'm going to explain it very quickly to you. It can be summarized by this statement. Who owns the plutonium and how much is it worth? Right now, the utilities own the plutonium inventory. The federal government would like to take it away from them, and it really belongs to the ratepayer, who has to pay for its mining, fabrication into fuel, operation in a reactor to get electricity, and now the federal government wants to throw it away at a cost of $300,000 a ton, just to encapsulate it and throw it away under the soil, without the tribute that's being paid of a dollar per megawatt hour.
All right, I'd like to finish this up, but running out of time here. But either way, if you go, if you want to listen to the, both of these videos, I posted them in the Super Chat room. And so if you listen to what Galen Windsor was talking about then, keep in mind he lived to be 82 years old, so that ought to tell you something. But either way, the people out there complaining about nuclear power, or even the people complaining about global warming and all this craziness going on, they just flat out ignore the truth, and they flat out ignore real science. And so what is their ultimate agenda? You know, you have to ask that question, because if you're not willing to entertain any possible solution to any problem that you claim exists that is going to be, you know, a danger to society as a whole, you know, going to cause our mass extinction or whatever, and you're just flat out ignoring people like myself that talk about different ways that we can engineer machinery and use energy, electricity or fuel related, whatever, doesn't matter. We have every single piece of the puzzle necessary to resolve all the so-called problems, yet they're always ignored. The environmentalists, I hold them responsible. The government, the Congress, Senate, I hold them responsible, and definitely, without a doubt, the mainstream industry and energy departments, including the EPA and the energy portion of the government as well. All of them are responsible for the fact that we can't seem to get our act together. And everyone continuously sees rises in their utility bills, their fuel costs, food prices, everything. It's all intertwined. Every single bit of what we played here today on today's podcast is intertwined. It all is connected in one form or fashion or another, because if you give the world free energy, then that means the prices of everything else is going to have to go down as well, because of the fact that they use these lies, these excuses, danger or doomsday, in order to jack the prices up on everything under the sun. Now, the fact that nobody in the, what they like to classify as third world countries, and if you've listened to me long enough, you know what I think about that terminology, should be no third world countries. But nonetheless, if you see all the problems that's going on over there, and there's somebody saying there's resolutions to it, why are these people suffering, not being able to get fresh water or heating and cooling or food or shelter, all this kind of stuff? It's because of the greed of man. Plain and simple. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. We have the capability to resolve it. The hypocrites of the world, like the environmentalists and the government agencies and supposed representation in the mainstream energy industries, as well as the automotive and the medical. So we could point the finger forever and a day, but until we the people decide to come together and seek out the real truth and share this information widely, we're never going to see any change in the way that society does. This is why Mad Science and Shaziz Radio and People for People Radio Network are so important. So with that said, folks, peace and love. You've been listening to Mad Science. If you like this podcast, share it with people. Stay tuned for the Music with Care Hour. Take care.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.